Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Eastern Bank. Eastern Bank is committed to helping people and businesses prosper, investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, a new poll from Monmouth University finds that more than 2 in 5 Republicans still say they plan to avoid getting a COVID-19 vaccine, even after millions of doses have been safely distributed. NBC political director Chuck Todd will join us on that, and the prospect of Washington, D.C. becoming a state. Then we'll ask you about how the post-vaccination family reunions are going.
The officer who says she mistook her gun for a taser when she shot Dante Wright has been charged with manslaughter. It turns out this isn't the first time an officer has mistaken a service weapon for a stun gun, though prosecuting cases like this are very complicated. Andrew Cabral will join us to discuss this legal case and more ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
I'm in a mood again today. Nice to see you, Marjorie. I'll try to act nice. Has nothing to
do
with you.
You know, when are you not in a mood,
That's a very good question. That's a very good point. Joining us on the phone is Chuck Todd. Chuck is the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. That, of course, is Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director of NBC News. Hello, Chuck Todd.
Hello there.
Hello, how are you?
Hello, Chuck Todd. So everything is political, as we know now, Chuck Todd. And I'm not sure what we do about these this new poll that talks about the vaccine hesitancy among Republicans, 43% men, Republican men, 45% not getting it, with different states saying they're not going to have any vaccine passports and stuff. At some point, does the president have to step in here? Or is it just going to be private industry regulating? Or what are we going to – I don't know. I mean, I don't know. But it is, I think, scary in terms of herd immunity and getting back life to normal.
Well, it is sort of weird. We have this, you know, basically – and, Tucker Carlson's, I guess, the avatar for this group of people. Mm-hmm. But it's this group of people that no matter what, whatever the majority says should be doing, Tucker and his minions say no, right? Whatever it is, right? And it's some sort of, you know, it's nihilist. I don't know what it is. I guess it's nihilism in some form or another. Because they're only, obviously, the first person they're harming is themselves, right? By not wanting to get this vaccine and all of that. But it is, I think it is a growing problem. I think it's a more serious problem than maybe we know how to tackle, right? We keep dealing with it as a political problem, but it's like, this is, you know, it is creating, you know, we're going to have where you can't do business in certain places or you can't do certain things because you have this class of nihilists that are, you know, in the name of the culture war or whatever bogus garbage they're coming up with as an excuse, you know, not sort of like almost helping to sabotage our society, right? Like not getting vaccinated is sabotage. You are sabotaging us collectively. And it's weird. It's not just self-sabotage, right? It hurts all of us. And this vaccine passport thing, and this is just one of the weirder things. I mean, This is why the Republican Party of today is unrecognizable from the one the rest of us. You know, the last thing I would have expected the Republican Party to do would be to want to have big government tell private business how to conduct their business. But this vaccine passport ban, how else do you view it other than a big government attempt to control business? And to control, it's so weird on that front because it's such an unfamiliar thing to have Republicans be advocating. So on that front too, it's a form of sabotage. And I think maybe that's how it should be framed because it's, you know, it looks nihilistic, but it's certainly it hurts all of us.
Yeah. We're talking to Chuck Todd from Meet the Press. Well, I said that how politics is into everything. I was reading Axios this morning and I was rather surprised to see, I guess a lot of Republicans are mad at the baseball because they decided to move their All-Star game. But it talked about favorability of sports in Republicans of Republicans liking sports in general. And, of course, the NFL took a big hit among Republicans after then-President Trump got mad at the NFL players for taking a knee. I guess the NFL is like a minus five among Republicans. The NBA,
oh, the NBA,
rather,
I saw that. Well, Jesus, that doesn't scream race. I don't know what does. Republicans are afraid of black empowerment. The NBA is, of all the sports leagues, probably the best at helping promote black empowerment a little bit. And apparently that's offensive to some Republicans. It is.
And
you saw that.
It's only hockey.
Say this, but you're like, yeah, well.
Anyway, yeah, it's only hockey, I guess, that's holding it.
You know, what's the racial makeup of those? What's the racial makeup of that?
Exactly.
You know, I think it's mostly white players.
This conversation is making me even more aggravated than I was before we started. Yeah. And so let me bring up something that's going to even accentuate this. You said screaming race. Speaking of screaming race, is there? We know a House committee either did or is about to pass the D.C. statehood thing. The full House is likely to pass it. Is there any reason why it won't get 60 votes? Is there any reason why they shouldn't have representation in Congress, other than the fact that they'll have two black senators and a black member of the House?
It you know, it's the only, there isn't a logical argument. If you want to, if somebody were serious about saying, well, look, the district, you know, it deserves representation, maybe it should be part of Virginia or Maryland. You know, if you're going to oppose DC statehood, at least come back with that, right? But there's not even the fig leaf of that, right? It's not like those that are opposed to D.C. statehood are going, you know, you're right, though. You are, you know, you're not, it isn't fair. What about this? You know what I mean? It's become, to me, it's another one that you sit there and you scream race. And again, compare D.C. and Wyoming.
Exactly.
Explain to me, compare D.C. and Wyoming. And you're sitting there and it's like, why? If Wyoming is worthy of being a state, why isn't D.C.? And if land mass is the reason, then why is Rhode Island a state? I mean, where are we going? Right?
Like, it's right.
Like, we can, you know, no matter how you want to have this argument, you look silly making it. Again, the one argument I would accept as a legitimate debate point here, because it's something as somebody who's been a resident here now for 31 years, has been the occasional, well, you know, look, the district, they never thought it was going to become a place where so many people were going to live. Okay, well, do we give it back to Maryland? Do you just have the, you know, there, that is, okay, that's an argument too, but at least that's one grounded in pro-representation, right? Like, you are hoping that a group of unrepresented citizens get real representation. But the fact that that's not even one of the ideas out there shows you it's you know, this is just a fig leaf opposition. It's really about race.
Talking to Chuck Todd from
Meet the Press. And politics. I mean, it's race and power. I mean, that's intertwined. I mean, look, if they thought they were, and here's my view on it, this idea that, oh, they'll never elect the Republican district, that's just not true. It's just not true. Politics abhors a vacuum. And, you know, Republicans have gotten elected in Hawaii. Democrats have gotten elected in Alaska. Yeah. There's a Democratic governor in Wyoming in my lifetime. This happens because nobody ever likes one power party rule forever. The other party, when they lose, a good one figures out how to win.
Well, speaking of race and power, and police in a lot of places, certainly in Boston, are very powerful with politicians. I'm wondering if this Derek Chauvin trial is going to have any impact on any kind of national police reform, or if that too is all going to come down to what we've been talking about before, race, politics, and power.
Well, I'm optimistic that you're going to see some local police reform, right? Because you're going to have places that demand it, and they'll be responsive, right? You know, you're seeing it, and Minneapolis is trying to respond, right, with different things. And I think those where the city has some control over things, I think you're going to see some of that. But I don't think you're going to see it on a national level right now. I think it does feel a bit, it does feel as if the Republicans are not, you know, there's just not enough Republicans interested. I think there are, you know, a handful, but not enough that feel politically comfortable doing it publicly. And so I have to tell you, after the incident in Virginia, you know, and what led to the incident in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota.
Yeah.
Can we have a serious conversation about the traffic stop? I mean,
yeah.
I just, you know, I have to tell you, I, you know, look, I just got a ticket driving in New Orleans, 4 miles and over the speed limit. It was a photo ticket. And I'm irritated.
Four miles?
Oh, I'm not kidding. It was a,
God.
24 and a 20. I was going 24 and a 20. We were down there to take my daughter for a tour of a school. Going 24 and a 20, right? So on one hand, you're like, this is ridiculous, right? No cop would have pulled me over. On the other hand, at the end of the day, I will put up with the photo enforcement, all that stuff, right? We have this stuff because at least that can be neutral, right? Yeah. That's race neutral or whatever. You know, my wife has a theory that maybe we were targeted because our license plate wasn't a Louisiana license plate. She goes, I wonder if we would have gotten that if we had a Louisiana license plate. But anyway, the point was, I do think we have the technology. We don't, you know, how many, you know, they had a brake light that was out. We shouldn't be pulling people over for that because it just feels as if those are the confrontations that suddenly escalate for no reason more often than not. And there's something about, you know, where automatically the person being pulled over feels like they're about to be arrested. The police officer assumes the worst. And it just, nobody can explain to me how that is an effective way of crime stopping.
Well, I can explain to you it's such a good idea, which means it will never get anywhere by definition. So is the Republican response to having that serious conversation that it's a slippery slope? When you let traffic violators do whatever they do, then it's going to be B&E types, and
well,
then it's going to be is that what the argument is?
Giuliani. It's the squeegee. Well,
that's right. That's
Giuliani.
Right. That's right.
Squeegee
right.
guy. Right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, and here's the thing, and some people conflate it with the broken windows theory of policing, right? You know, but I actually think broken windows theory, that's a different story. You want to make sure a neighborhood, you know, you don't let any small crime go by in a neighborhood. There's, you know, but everything got, I think, overdone, particularly by Rudy and company. And everybody took one little idea and then thought, okay, this is now the square peg that we're going to pound this nail in this round, you know. But I do think that's right. That's where you're going to get the pushback is saying, well, when you do that, you know, then all of a sudden you're passive about certain things. But I don't think you are. I mean, that's the thing. Nobody's saying we're going to tolerate speeders. Yeah, they're going to get photoed and you're going to get these things. And, you know, yeah, they may get to the point where you lose your plates or something, you know. But it would cut back on these confrontations that seem to – because too often I feel like police officers – assume there's another crime being committed if they had a brake light out. And is that really, you know, that,
yes.
When does that not border on right to, you know, don't you, you know, there's a privacy invasion to it. So, I mean, I just think that there's more trouble, a traffic stop with most traffic stops potential than there is an upside outcome to it.
Can I add one more argument to your arsenal there? And which is an argument, a variation of a theme that our, DA in Suffolk County, where Boston is, has been arguing. She won't prosecute 15 comparatively minor offenses, misdemeanor offenses. And part of the reason, beyond the fact that it leads to more involvement in a negative way in the criminal justice system that affects everybody, not just the individual negatively, is cops should be doing more important things than stopping people for going 4 minutes over, 4 miles an hour over the right. whatever the limit is, and so that they can do things that matter to protect our safety and keep our community. You know, there's one congressman, you may
I think that's your better argument, by the way. You're making the case of, hey, we should have police doing less traffic stops, less, frankly, harassment of citizens, and more focus on bigger problems. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, as I started to tell you, I'm not sure you know this, but Matt Gaetz has said that he would support no traffic stops if there was no Venmo investigations permitted to. Do you think that's a fair trade-off? So his good buddy's flipping on your guy,
can I
right?
I tell you, apparently, what's funny is the wrong word, but everything, it seems like he flipped a lot long. Every time you look, did he just flip? Oh, wait, has he been talking for 3 months? He's been talking for 8 months? Like, I think Matt Gaetz isn't sure when his guy flipped. And that's got to scare him. I have to say, Stephen Colbert had the joke of the day, though. He said, you know, the Afghanistan war is ending after 20, will end after, you know, 20 years. A war that's too old for Matt Gaetz to date. And I just, you know, it just killed me. It was so good.
We're allowed to laugh at that, aren't we? I hope we are.
I'm sorry. Why can't
know.
We? It's
oh, that
Stephen
is
Colbert,
good.
Right?
That is good.
He's the comedian
exactly.
of Voice America, right? Isn't it? Yeah, he gives permission slips.
I want to know if the Matt Gaetz wedding invitations have gone out yet. I don't know. The fiance might be rethinking this whole situation. I'm not sure.
You know, I don't know about you. I always operate on the, all right, well, I'll assume 90% of it isn't true, but I still got a problem with 10% of it, you know, if you're her, right? Like, let's say you operate on 90% of it isn't true.
Right.
What about the 10 that is? Right, yeah.
Yeah,
hey,
exactly.
Chuck, can we spend the last minute or so on something else that will go nowhere in Congress? And this one is on the list of things we're talking about. This is one where there are actually two sides to it as opposed to what we've talked about.
Yeah.
Our own Ed Markey and Jerry Nadler from New York have filed a bill to expand the Supreme Court to 13 seats. We know that President Biden last week appointed this commission to look at the Supreme Court thing. And Biden, we know, is not crazy about what critics call court packing or expanding the court. Do you have what possible thing could this purported bipartisan commission recommend about the Supreme Court other than maybe cameras in the courtroom that well, I don't even know if it's cameras in the courtroom that both sides could ever agree upon?
I think age limit.
I think
there's something there on age limits. I think that's the most realistic reform.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think Ed Markey and Jerry Nadler have successfully helped the right fundraise for the next 2 weeks, to be frank. I think that's all that bill will do is help the right wing raise a ton of money, and it ain't going to help the left raise that much money because the passion on the courts is definitely still tips towards the right here. But I think the commission, I have not heard a good argument for expanding the Supreme Court. It is true that there's nothing about nine that makes it sacred.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what is the, you know, what I'm trying to figure out is what's the argument? Why do we need 7-6 decisions? Why do they make, why will that be better than 5-4s? You know, so I think the real issue may be, to me, is judicial term limits. Like, how do you define lifetime appointment? I can tell you this, the lifetime appointments in 1790, you know, they didn't live much past.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
Granted, the elites lived a little bit longer than average Americans, but even they lived maybe into their 60s. So I do think lifetime to me is a generation. I've always looked at it. I don't think anybody should be in the court after 25 years. An entire generation. Think about what life was like 25 years ago.
Yeah.
No iPhone, barely had an internet, right? You know, are you telling me something? You know, to me is your public expiration date. You know, on that, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Now, how would they institute it? You know, I could see making, say, 25 years or 80, you know, and maybe if you're not yet 80, maybe you can get a 1 5-year extension and that's it or something like that. Like that, I think, is something both sides could agree to, because I think we all think, okay, especially it's getting silly now if you're like, well, find 35-year-olds who have never done anything but just had a terrific, you know, scored high in the bar exam and were amazing law students. Make them a federal judge. You know, if you created some sort of term limit a little bit or age limit, I don't want to call it a term limit, age limit, then maybe you would disincentivize the youthivize, you know, how much we keep making, you know, this younger and younger, you know, this game look younger and younger. So, and that way you'd have a little more experience in the court. So my point is, I know I've got a little windy here. That's my hope. I'm a little Pollyannish on commission sometimes. That's the one, to me, the most realistic thing that could come out of it.
From your lips to their ears. Chuck, good to talk to you.
Thank you, Chuck.
You got it. I look forward to running the world on my own someday.
Yeah, don't we all? Chuck Todd is the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers around here. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Coming up, Family Matters. We're opening the lines, asking you about the vaccine and if it's given you the opportunity to reunite with your family for the first time in over a year, maybe even give them a hug. That is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And Marjorie, before we continue, I just want to say today would have been the birthday of somebody we both loved a lot. The late, great, wonderful, sweetest man on the planet, Chet Curtis, would have been his birthday today. And I just wanted to take a second.
Oh, my goodness.
And mention what an incredibly sweet and wonderful soul Chet was. So in any case.
And a great newscaster for many years.
He was indeed. He really was. So first came the vaccine selfies, people uploading pictures of themselves, getting the long-awaited shot. Now comes the family reunion selfies. Thanks to the vaccine, grandparents and pandemic babies are meeting for the first time. Parents and their children are getting together after a year apart. Aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, throw in some family dogs and cats if you want. You've got family reunions taking place every day. The New York Times, I don't know if you saw this, Marjorie, is soliciting pictures, photos of family reunions. Advice columnists are reminding people how to socialize with relatives after a stressful year apart. But for most of us, it is pure intuition. It's a hug, tears of joy. Maybe it's an eye roll from one too many dad jokes, or maybe it's experiencing the awe of holding that bundle of a newborn kid, that grandkid, for the first time. We're taking your calls asking you about your post-vaccine reunions, the ones you've had or the ones you're counting the days until. The number is 877-301-8970. Both of my daughters, as I think people know, are grown, as are your three kids. I hadn't hugged either of my daughters in a year. And finally, when I became fully vaccinated, when fully vaccinated happened here, and then she had been as well, one of the great moments ever, ever on the street where she lives in the South End, it was unbelievable. I mean, there are no words to describe. And I know a ton of people have had those experiences.
I know. I mean, lots of people have been doing just the elbow bump kind of thing or just doing nothing. I think it's really great. Mothers and kids, you know, sisters and brothers, cousins. I mean, it's just a wonderful thing that more of us are getting vaccinated and that more people are feeling that they can see. I mean, the people I feel the worst for, not the people that haven't hugged their grandkids, which is really tough, a newborn baby, but the people that have not been able to have wakes and funerals for people that have died.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's really tough too. And you go to the wake and the funeral, nobody can hug anybody. Nobody can sit near anybody else. It's weird. So, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel, even with this temporary, I hope, setback with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, we're getting near, I hope,
hug time.
The beginning of the end of this disaster.
You know, what's incredible? When I was thinking about this and when I saw the New York Times thing and the headline, if you're looking for it, is show us your pandemic baby family reunions. They're looking for all these family reunion photos. I can't believe when we did a show about 3 weeks ago, four weeks ago, we were asking listeners, including ourselves, plus ourselves, you know, what's the one thing you're most looking forward to when you're fully vaccinated? And I can't believe I said shopping at the supermarket or the grocery store. And I, by the way, I don't mean because I didn't want to do that badly. And I did. And then I subsequently did. Well, I think it was two Saturdays ago. I was, quote, fully vaccinated. But hugging the kid thing, I can't believe how humiliating that I hadn't thought of that. But that is really, really something, you know?
It's okay, Jim. I said I wanted to go to a bar.
Oh, that's what it was.
That's not very distinguished.
And you've got three grown kids,
that's not very distinguished either. Although I must admit, my oldest kid had a teeny tiny COVID wedding this year, and it was outside. And I think we were doing the hugs then, but you put your...
No, but those don't... Exactly.
You got to turn your head. Your mouth and your nose was going away from the person.
Yes, doesn't
count.
Yeah,
turn your head hugs. So that was really... They were kind of half-baked hugs. So yeah, it's great. It's great. I think a lot of people... You know, we've read a million stories and talked a million times about how people miss touch. You know, that's a big deal. And I think it's great that that we can touch each other again.
But can I add one more thing to this discussion? The way we conceived of this was purely an intra-family thing. There are also a ton of friends And we've talked about some of them, you and I, off the
air. Oh, absolutely.
But you haven't been able to see, except, you know, in a distance kind of way, mm-hmm. in ages. The ability to go out to dinner with a close friend or whatever is just, and hug him or her, is unbelievable. So all these reunions we want to talk about, the ones you've had, if you're lucky enough to be fully vaccinated, as Marjorie and I are, or if you or the person you want to reconnect with isn't fully vaccinated yet, what is thinking about that moment that is hopefully right over the horizon or right on the horizon doing for you? 877-301-8970. Hello?
NBPR at WGBH.org if you want to email, or at Boss Public Radio if you want to tweet us about your reunion fantasies, if you haven't managed to do it yet, or what you've already done in your reunion with family members. 877-301-8970. Let's start with Lee in Worcester County. Thanks for calling, Lee.
Hello, Lee.
Oh, thank you. Love your show. Listen every day. And
thanks.
You've been a bright spot during this all.
Thanks.
My husband and I are dying to see our girls. We haven't seen our oldest daughter for 3 years.
Oh, my
she
God.
She lives in London. And we haven't, but we were going to go that February, before, you know, just when it blew up in March.
Yeah.
Oh.
She had been at a Microsoft conference in Seattle and then had to go to, she oversees the Asia team. And she was in a conference in Arizona, flew back to London, didn't feel well, but no one ever thought it would be COVID.
Mm.
But they shut down right away at the end of February. She was working from home. And then our youngest daughter has been in L.A. for two years, and we haven't seen her for 2 years. So we're planning. We're fully vaccinated today, and we have tickets to go to L.A. And I could cry. In June, she's a teacher in L.A., and we're just thrilled. We can't believe it. We don't even want to think too hard on it because we're afraid it won't happen. And we don't know when we'll get to London, it's just been horrible not being able to see our girls other than through Zoom.
You were exactly the first.
Well.
You're the first call we were hoping for. That is exactly the spirit that I think everybody who hasn't had the moment yet is dreaming about. That was a beautiful call, Lee, and we wish you great reunions with both of your daughters as soon as is humanly possible. 877-301-8970. You know, you mentioned the thing. By the way, when your kid, what do you call it, a teeny tiny wedding that your older
teeny
daughter
teeny tiny had? COVID wedding, yes.
Teeny tiny COVID wedding. Mm-hmm. I assume, because I was doing this for a couple of months too, you looked it up in the New York Times. It was a story about how you're supposed to hug during COVID if you weren't vaccinated.
Yes. Yeah.
And it had all the things about how long you should hug.
Very quickly.
Both of your faces should be in different directions.
Direction.
You had to plan it out before you did it. And it was satisfying, but it was not quite as good as this.
I don't know if you've seen the front page of the Globe today, but there's a great happy story about Tito Jackson, former city councilor in Boston. He ran for mayor of Boston, hugging his birth mother, but he's finally been united. And Tito's a big guy, and he's got these bare arms around his mother that he's finally – it's a great story about him, but you just thought to yourself – gosh, 6 months ago, what if he had to do an elbow knock with his birth mother that he finally
Well, by the way, also,
with?
Not that isn't today's topic, but isn't she featured in Common Ground, by the
way? Yes, she is featured in Common Ground.
Is that incredible?
And, she was a young, pregnant woman who was shipped off to Charlestown as a pregnant girl, and she was pregnant as a result of sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a great story.
He's a terrific
guy,
good
for Tito.
Way,
he's a great guy. Brad from Manchester, thank you for calling.
Hello, Brad.
Hi. I just want to tell you guys, that conversation with Chuck Todd was amazing. I have never heard so many lies packed into such a short segment.
Which lie?
Oh, I was hoping you would ask.
Well, I did.
First of all, he said that the founders never envisioned a city that large. Oh, that's I mean, cursory search of Google will tell you that's a lie. Mm. The founders compared it to London, and Franklin compared it to Paris, which both at the time had a greater population than D.C. does now. So they did envision a large city. I tend to think the founders had some good ideas, and I don't see why we need to go against
Hey, Brad, how about the non-lie that there are people that live there, hundreds of thousands of people live there, who have zero representation in Congress? How about that non-lie?
Well, there was a good argument for that. Didn't the founders have a good
argument? No, I didn't ask you. No, you talked about the founders. I'm talking about today when 600,000 or 700,000 people don't have any representation in Congress.
That brings me to lie number two.
Am I allowed to finish a sentence, Brad? You spoke, and I'd like to speak. What is your response to that, which is not a lie? They are unrepresented, and they pay taxes. What's your response to that?
That brings me to lie number two, that Republicans never suggested giving it to Maryland.
Brad, for the third time, third and final time, is it okay that they are unrepresented in Congress? Yes or no?
It's the envisionment of the...
Brad, thanks for calling. 877-301-8970. Answer the question. We keep talking. You avoid the question. We end talking. But, Brad, thank you kindly. That was an excellent call. Caitlin in Providence, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi, that took a turn.
It did. He calls. I think he calls a lot, doesn't he?
He can call, but it would be nice to be spoken.
Listen, I'm glad he listens.
Caitlin, what's up?
We have a lot of people that don't agree with us.
So, I'm actually following up on a call I gave you guys a few weeks ago about a COVID wedding I was attending here in Rhode Island. It went great. It was sort of the first thing I've been to in this last year that was sort of like, oh my God, I forgot what real life felt like. Got to give lots of friends and family hugs. We were all masked, of course. By the end of the night, my voice was hoarse from yelling through a mask. But it was really wonderful. It was indoors, 75 people. You had to get a negative COVID test within 48 hours beforehand. But beyond that, it went really well. And it was just so nice to see. It was the first time in a year that I had seen cousins, aunts, uncles. And it was just really, really nice.
Isn't it amazing? You know,
hey, Caitlin, what are the rules in Rhode Island? Because I think Massachusetts, can we have 75 indoor wedding gatherings yet? I don't know.
I don't know what the number is.
But you can
is.
There. Do you know what the rule is there?
So in Rhode Island, the
there?
Max is 100.
100. That's pretty. That's
indoor.
Not bad.
Outdoor, I'm not sure, but indoor, 100.
Caitlin, thanks for sharing your story. We really appreciate it. 877-301-8970. You know, if someone had said to you... What?
There is one advantage of the teeny tiny COVID wedding.
What's that?
Save a lot of money.
Yeah, I know, but that's really a rotten thing to admit on the air. It's honest, but it's a rotten thing to admit.
Well,
so if someone
the wedding
said,
industrial complex has gotten out of hand, Jim. It's just gotten out of hand.
That it has. What's the average wedding cost in Massachusetts? Is it $45,000? Is that what it is or something like that?
I don't know. But, you know, you're stunned that before you even have a Coca-Cola or come in the door, some of these places are $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 just to rent. For the wedding. It's unbelievable.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Wendy in Lexington.
Thank you, Wendy.
I know. Well, I thought I'd throw that
in.
Wendy in Lexington. Hi, Wendy.
Hi.
Hey. So we're actually getting to see our parents, and we're leaving tomorrow. We're driving since our kids are not vaccinated yet, but we're fully vaccinated. They are fully vaccinated. And I'm getting teary just thinking about it. So we're just so excited to see them after a year and a half.
A year and a half.
They live down in Alabama, so it's just been really hard. And speaking of Alabama, I mean, 10 years, or it's been 12 years since we got married. It was $25,000 for a wedding. and that was like cutting costs and everything. So
yeah, it's crazy.
Hey, Wendy.
We're very excited to see you.
I love your sentiment, but can I ask you a question, please? Alabama, I don't want to rain on any parade because I think it's great, and it's great the way you described it. Alabama is one of those states I read last week where sadly, the supply is exceeding demand. There are a lot of people, apparently for political or anti-science reasons, that are just saying no to the vaccine. Are your parents nervous about that, or are they okay? Wendy?
Oops.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you for a second. Could you hear what I said? Or?
No, I'm sorry. We haven't had any technical problems today for a change, so our apologies. Can you say it again?
That's okay. I'm used to repeating myself with four kids.
So. No, it's our fault, not yours. Go ahead, Wendy.
It's not a problem at all. It actually got me past that nervous stage. That's okay. We are actually traveling to Alabama tomorrow to see our family. Who's been vaccinated. My husband and I have been vaccinated. We are driving from Massachusetts. But we figured that would be a lot safer since our kids are not vaccinated. We have four, and then COVID gave us one more surprise. So we will have 5 kids, and we're going to do a gender reveal there with our parents. And it'll be great.
Wendy, that is great. Drop us an email when you get back, and let it bprwgbh.org, and let us know how it went. Good luck and enjoy. You know, that, as Wendy said, she was welling up when she was talking about a year and a half. She and her kids have not seen her parents, and her kids have not seen their grandparents.
I know.
What I started to say to you before, but we had a technical problem, which is not unusual on this show. Can you, if someone had said to you 2 years ago, there's going to come a time in the near future when you're not going to see your, I mean, I'm not talking about you in particular, your sibling for a year. You're not going to see your parents for a year and a half. You're not going to see your grandkids. Can you imagine even having lived through that, the anticipation of someone you care deeply about being, you know, apart from you? For, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Thought it was going to be 2 weeks. Then we thought it was going to be another 2 weeks. And then we thought it was going to be another couple. I mean, I think we just hadn't.
You know, I can't hear you. Can we take a break so that I don't have a stroke, if you don't mind, please? I'm sorry. Let's take a brief break, and hopefully things will improve when we return. Is that okay?
We're going to take a brief break. We're talking about reunions. We're talking about reunions, post-pandemic reunions, how great that is. We're going to keep talking about it. Our number is 877-301-8970, bprwgbh.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. Boston Public Radio is the show where we can't hear the listeners. Listeners can't hear us. I can't hear Marjorie, and Marjorie can't hear me. Despite that, if you were just tuning in, we're talking about the first family or friend reunion you guys are having, or at least anticipating after a year of living in lockdown. Thanks to the vaccine, people are getting back together, seeing one another in person for the first time in over a year. You've heard some wonderful examples from our callers so far. We're taking your calls asking you, what was that first encounter like, or what do you anticipate the first encounter being like with a friend, a family member, somebody you really care about, or some bodies you really care about who you simply have been unable to see for pretty obvious reasons? 877-301-8970. You want to talk about how expensive weddings are, or we're
past that, but I have bad news. My call screener is down too, so you
fabulous.
Guys.
Fabulous. Excellent. Emily in Ipswich. You are next on Boston Public Radio.
Emily in Ipswich, thank you for calling.
Can you hear me now?
We do, sort of, Emily. Okay. Welcome to the show.
Right. Thanks very much, you guys. You're very entertaining.
Yes, we can.
I love you guys.
Thanks.
My mother is 96 years old, and she's had health issues from this time last year. She actually ended up getting COVID, and obviously I couldn't see her. She ended up having to move from an assisted living facility in and out of a hospital where I could not see her.
Oh,
I could only speak with the doctors. Blah. Anyway, she ended up in long-term care, and finally they're letting people in, and I did get to go in, but I was told by the administration, you need to stay 6 feet apart. They put us 6 feet apart. Don't take your mask off, no hugging. So as soon as those people left, because my mother and I both have had both of our shots, we embraced and we both sobbed. It was just the most expression of love I can really remember. And she and I both benefited from it. My point is the administrators need to be a little more compassionate. Too many rules at this point.
Well, you know what? Tragically, Emily, one of the rules isn't that that the people that work there have to get vaccinated. I mean, this is another big issue.
Right.
And part of it
right.
is that they're paid so poorly that they have to go from place to place, apparently, from everything I've read. But it does seem really unfair to people that are confined, like your mother, and being taken care of by people who are not getting vaccinated.
Well, not only unfair to her mother, unfair to her mother's daughter. Emily,
yeah.
Emily, that is a beautiful story, and I am so glad
Emily wanted
you broke
to finish
the
something.
Rules. I'm sorry.
She wanted to finish something. Go ahead, Emily.
I want to say, I work as a massage therapist as well, and I just am so mindful of what the touch is all about. And
sure.
these older people, they don't get touched in a loving way very often. So it was a very wonderful experience for the both of us.
That's great. Hey, thank you very much, Emily, for calling.
Thanks.
Lori just emailed and said, I went to see my 3-year-old nephew and 4-year-old niece. They barely knew her, of course, because she hasn't seen them in such a long time. And Katie just emailed and said her fully vaccinated sister came over a week ago or so and had dinner with the family. And her normally shy 8-year-old was so excited to see her aunt. Gosh. She wouldn't leave her alone the whole time. And she's concerned about when kids are going to be able to get vaccinated. But that's not going to be 16 and above, but little kids, I don't know when they're going to be able to get vaccinated. But the good news we keep hearing is that little kids are less likely, at least in the school setting, to spread this. So,
well, the other piece of good news is, I think, am I not right about this? That Pfizer is applying soon for emergency use authorization. I'm not sure for how much below 16. It's 15 down to X, whatever it is, but the hope is that if they get one of the segments of the under 16 population approved, then hopefully it will move from there, but it's not imminent. That is true.
Alan in Cranston, thank you for calling.
Charlton.
Oh, Charlton, I'm sorry.
Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great.
Fine, thanks.
Okay, I have a couple of good ones here. My wife and I have not been able to see my son. He had moved out to Oregon 2 years ago, and we went out to visit him when he first moved, and that was 21 months ago. And so it's really tearing my wife up quite a bit about this. And so we're putting her on a plane early next week, and she's going to fly out and see him. Unfortunately, I can't go right away. We're going to drive out later in the year, and we'll both get to see him then. But, I mean, this is, her baby. She has to go see her baby. And 21 months is huge. She's never been away from this long, and it's really
insane.
Alan, what have you done? Have you done like Zoom and FaceTime like everybody else? Is that what you've done?
We do that. We do that. We've been doing that all the time. We even had planned a trip for us to go out and take a cruise with him in June, but that was canceled because they canceled the Canadian. It was going to go out of Vancouver, and they canceled all those just recently. We do see him, and it's good to be able. It's good to be able to do that, but it's not the same.
No.
And then my other story was my daughter-in-law. Now, I called you guys about her in the beginning of the COVID. She was a COVID doc in Boston, and she was at Boston Medical Center, and she is an infectious disease doc, and she was dealing with COVID, basically the entire year. And it's obviously very hard for those doctors and what they've seen. And she was just a new, she's a young doctor. So she is kind of a trial by fire. I mean, her first big infectious disease thing, and here it is, COVID. And she had a lot of, all her patients were COVID patients for a year. And she went back home to see her parents in Portugal this week for the first time in We all were together in 2020, New Year's Day. We had spent New Year's Eve together, so it's been a while for her. And I told her she looked so recharged after only being with her mother and father for 2 days. It was amazing. It was like a veil was lifted off of her. And she told me it's not just her parents, but her friends and they're all docs in Portugal too. But it was so great to see how happy she was, and how you don't when you see somebody day to day, and I did because they're in Boston, so I do get to see them. They're docs, and they were injected, and we were injected, and we FaceTime, but also have together time. But being able to see how it helped her getting home and seeing her parents, it was touching.
Alan, thanks for sharing that with us. Those are all great.
The call. Joe just emailed and said, we've just seen our parents who are around 80, and he talked about a noticeable decline in the last 12 months because no outside stimulation has taken its toll on their mental and emotional state. And that's so true. I mean, imagine just being stuck in your apartment, for all this time with very little outside stuff going on. It's not easy.
Well, in terms of deterioration, if I can, just for a second, James, hold 1 second. Mm-hmm. If you're pretty old, as a lot of people in nursing homes are, And since no one knew when this was going to wind down, you thought you might never see your kid or your grandkid or your sibling or whoever again.
People being, that's why I'm so upset about nursing homes not saying that their staffs have to get vaccinated, because you hear stories of people in their room, eating in their room. They're not going to eat in a common area. They're not meeting to play bridge, which a lot of older people love, well, a lot younger people too, but particularly older people love, you know, play bridge. All those activities are just shut off, so you're in your room. I mean, I cannot imagine what that's like for
you. Know what was this was early on in the pandemic. Well, I'm sure it continued for a while. That was both beautiful and heartbreaking. I know you saw this too. The photographs of people, particularly at nursing homes, visiting their spouse or their parent or their grandparent, standing outside the window, outside where the person in the nursing room was inside looking through the window, and this huge glass, thick glass, separated them. But you felt sort of love between these separated souls. It's just, it's incredible, and hopefully it's coming to an end. James in Boston, thanks for your patience. You're next. Hi.
Hi. So lie number three, you guys stated that conservatives don't like the NBA because of their black.
That's it?
Is this lie number three?
By the way, one of my favorite things beyond people lying to the call screeners is when they call back under a different name. That real, I love that kind of thing. And by the way, your calls have been so clever too today. So feel free to call again really, really soon. Miriam in Gloucester, you're
next.
Well,
we should just point out that the dramatic decrease in popularity with this survey this morning, Morning Consult poll, was after the NBA, a lot of NBA players began wearing Black Lives Matter shirts on the court during warm-up and were speaking out about Black Lives Matter. So maybe it's just a coincidence, Brad, but it happened.
Well, wait, Marjorie, can we take it a step further, please? Donald Trump was appalled by Kaepernick. But he thought the thousands of white people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th were loving people who went to embrace law enforcement and say how much they love them. I mean, come on.
Well, the same thing happened with the NFL at the time that the president called out Kaepernick. But it's okay, Brad. Brad's worked up about this, so I guess that's why he's
calling. Brad or James to you, by the way. Miriam in Gloucester, hi.
Hi. I had not seen my son and daughter-in-law and grandchildren who live in New Orleans for quite a while. And when my husband and I got fully vaccinated, first thing I did was book a ticket. And we go to Logan, we park the car in the parking garage, and we're on that walkway that takes you to the terminal. Mm-hmm. And I hear Governor Baker's voice on the loudspeaker saying, "Welcome to Massachusetts, the home of, you know, wonderful innovation and friendly people." And it was so great, even that getting that far out of the house and hearing him speak, it just totally, I got teary. I mean,
that is great.
That in itself was just enough.
That was
not
great.
Not quite enough, the beginning.
You know, I want to mention a little breaking news here. USA Today is reporting that the defense has rested in the Derek Chauvin trial. They haven't really presented that many witnesses, but they have rested. So,
and Chauvin's taking the fifth. He's not testifying.
Chauvin is not going to be testifying, right?
Miriam, thank you for another great one. We really appreciate your story as well. Thanks.
He spoke very briefly for the first time in court today, but he won't testify. Justin in the car, thank you for calling.
Hi, Justin.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys?
Great.
So I live in New Hampshire, and my sister lives in Rhode Island, and we got to see each other at her birthday party last summer outside, of course. I'm actually on my way to pick her up, and we're going to take a road trip down to visit my mom in Georgia. And she's been down there for about 5 years, and she usually comes up every year around Memorial Day. And then last year, I was like, I don't know, you should cancel your trip. This isn't good. And I had to have her put it off like three times. And then she was just never able to come. So it's really good that we're getting to go down there. But I'm honestly a little nervous because I feel like up in New England, we're in our bubble of protection. And everybody, for the most part, wears their masks and washes their hands and does what they need to. But I'm really nervous that as we get further south, that with their, you know, less stringent mask rules and social distancing, like it's had me on edge for about a week. So
You know, Justin, really, what I was trying to say when we had technical difficulties, I think with Wendy before, I think it was Wendy, who said she's going to Alabama to see her parents. I don't know if Georgia is one of these states, but there are a number of southern states. I know Alabama is one where, as I started to say to her, but she didn't hear me, the supply exceeds the demand for reasons of politics or anti-science beliefs. A huge percentage of the population is not getting vaccinated. So again, I'm not sure Georgia falls into that category, but I understand your concern. And, you know, it speaks to what Chuck Todd was telling us 40 minutes ago about sort of the selfishness of the beyond the lack of self-protection, the selfishness on the part of those. I know we're not supposed to shame those who avoid the vaccine, but it's how I feel. They're penalizing all the rest of us who do want to be safe and do want to see people we love. So, Justin, enjoy the trip and good luck. And thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. You know, that I'm like being aggravated by that again. The fact that, what was the number? 45 in one poll, 43% of Republicans in the country don't have any plan to get the vaccine. Is there any? I know we heard yesterday from Juliet, we hear from Mark Kaplan, don't shame the people not getting vaccinated. Is there any argument for not getting vaccinated in 2021 based upon the science and the facts? Is there one?
Well, I don't think so, unless you want to stay in your house and be in your house by yourself and not go anywhere. Because
right.
The issue is not you. The issue is that you could be asymptomatic and infect people. And even if you're vaccinated, you could still get COVID. You're not going to go to the hospital, we hope, and you're not going to die, we hope, but you could still infect other people. So I'm hoping that some private businesses just say, what was the expression from Mark Kaplan? No shirts, no shoes, no shot.
Yeah.
That
I like that.
You can't come in without a shot. I think that would make a lot of people feel better. Okay, coming up, as you just said, the defense has rested in the Chauvin trial. We're also going to talk with Andrew Cabral in this next segment about the fatal shooting of Dante Wright and a story about a Milton police officer. All that is next on a next edition of Law and Order. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Facebook whistleblower says leaders at the company ignored global political manipulation of the site. The data scientist, who's been fired from the company for alleged poor performance, maintains that executives led foreign national governments, especially ones in poorer nations and non-Western nations, manipulate the platform. Tech writer Andy Anatko will bring us up to speed.
For more than 20 years, the Boston Police Department kept a secret. One of their own, Officer Patrick Rose, was a child sexual predator. This secret allowed Rose to continue on the force, rise to the ranks of president of his own union, and continue working on cases that involve children. A bombshell investigation by the Boston Globe has shattered that secret at last, and reporter Andrew Ryan will join us to discuss it. All that and more ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. Joining us online for this week's edition of Law & Order is Andrew Cabral. Andrew is the former sheriff of Suffolk County, the former state secretary of public safety. She is now the CEO of Ascend. Hello there, Andrea.
Hello there, Jim, and hello there, Marjorie.
Hey.
Hello there, Andrew Cabral. Well, I just wanted to ask you really quickly, because it just happened. The defense has rested in the Derek Chauvin trial. Chauvin briefly has spoken today. He's declined to testify, invoking his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. But I guess what Jim and I were wondering and hoping you have a thought on this, since the evidence has been pretty overwhelming, why not just take a shot here and testify and try to maybe get a little jury sympathy? Or is that just too risky and too hopeless?
Well, if he got on the stand and he testified, then his history of excessive force, which actually includes, I believe, shooting
a previous point. Suspect would be ripe for coming in to evidence. So he'd be exposing himself and all of his, you know, prior inappropriate behavior as a police officer, at least that which the judge deemed to be relevant material, would come in, and the jury yep. would hear that, and which means that, you know, they're not, they wouldn't be able to look at this in a vacuum. It would be more placed in the context of his behavior over the course of his tenure as a police officer. But the other thing is, they are not, you can't dispute that Derek Chauvin kneeled on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes. They're trying to dispute the cause of death.
Right.
That's really where they focused their entire
case. That's a good point, too.
Putting him on the stand isn't going to affect that, right? There's nothing that he can say on the stand because he's not a pulmonologist or a neurologist, a coroner, none of those things. He's not a medical professional. Nothing that he could say on the stand would go directly to the cause of death, and that's where they're trying to focus distract the jury's attention.
You know, Andrew Cabral, a little bit later in the show, we're going to talk to Andrew Ryan from the Boston Globe, who's done brilliant reporting to expose the fact that a Boston cop who went on to be union president, Patrick Rose, was credibly accused of child molestation a couple of decades ago and was allowed to stay on the force and continue interacting with kids. And one of the things I'm going to ask him is, how can a Boston resident who has a problem that relates to their kid be confident when they call the Boston cops that they won't get a Patrick Rose? I feel the same way in Milton about people of color. This story in the Globe about Patricia Leo, who is a Milton cop, is so enraging, particularly since her racism was taken out on an underage person. Could you tell the story and give us your reaction to her behavior?
I agree. This is although I think the word outrage has now become completely
You're right.
meaningless.
You're right.
But this is an outrageous set of facts. So Patricia Leo has, I think, two sons. She's married, has two sons. And one of her sons had two guests who were going to do a sleepover. One is a young African-American kid above 14 years old. I think the other's 14, too,
yeah.
And is Hispanic. Her son, according to the story in the Globe, her son had shown her a post that had been, I won't say promoted, but probably had been liked or otherwise, you know, shown some, you know, favorable response by the black 14-year-old that related to Black Lives Matter and specifically to defunding police departments. Nothing in the post advocated violence against police. So it's unclear how much time elapsed between the time that she saw this, her son showed her this post, and when the boys got home, but they had gone to Legacy Place, presumably to see a movie. They came back to the house, they were watching a Celtics game, and in another room, she begins audibly sort of yelling about Black Lives Matter and that they're a phony organization, which then escalates into her direct confrontation with the black 14-year-old, where she is described in the story as being standing in his face with her fist clenched, screaming at him about whether or not, asking him whether or not he supports Black Lives Matter. And at one point, the 14-year-old says to her, because she's right up on him, "Are you going to hit me?" Which, you know, she says she's not. But her husband, who tries to pull her away from these kids, according to, I don't know if it's according to the guests, the two 14-year-old boys that were the guests, or her own sons, or both, but they say she swung on her own husband, punched him in the face, and his nose started to bleed. He then subsequently denied that and said that he had gotten an injury to his nose doing some construction work around the house. But I just find it really hard to believe that these two 14-year-olds would just manufacture a wife hitting her husband.
Yeah.
Versus his interest in not telling the police that his wife committed a domestic violence assault and battery on him. But, you know, I'll leave that to the courts. In any event, the husband then piles all the kids in the car, including his own son, because she's telling basically the 14-year-old, if you support Black Lives Matter, get the F out of my house, yeah. right? And so he's going to take the kids home. She is banging on the windows of the car and refers to the Hispanic 14-year-old, as calls him an immigrant, and she's furious. It's unclear whether or not she's furious because her alleged victim is being, you know, taken out of her control, or she's upset because her son is in the car with them. But in any event, it seems clear that she bangs on the car doors and is screaming and yelling. So they have this as a magistrate's hearing because it is a misdemeanor, not committed in the presence of a police officer other than the one who is accused of actually committing the offense. And when a misdemeanor doesn't occur in a police officer's presence, it's usually set up for a clerk's hearing. And she basically offers the defense that race had nothing to do with it, which is insane on its face. I wonder sometimes whether or not people actually hear themselves when they say this kind of stuff, because the issue here is her feelings about Black Lives Matter, which is specific to protesting the deaths of black people at the hands of police officers, largely unarmed black people. But in any event, she also offers as a defense that she is very much afraid of Black Lives Matter. She clearly sees them as an organization that advocates violence or killing of police, which she says at the clerk's hearing. It's just not okay. Now, keep in mind, the 14-year-old is not a member of Black Lives Matter. He has apparently liked a post that talked about defunding the police. But she's saying she's so afraid of Black Lives Matter that she got in the face of a 14-year-old and threatened him and intimidated him. Her behavior is so off the charts, inappropriate for her to hold a position of power as a police officer.
With a gun.
I almost don't have words for the entire thing. And she's, all of her issues are misplaced. I mean, you know, as we'll probably talk about later on in the show, she's got more to fear from the Boogaloo Boys than she's got from Black Lives Matter, who, to my knowledge, have never killed anyone.
You know,
but just the idea that she could have been that out of control with those kids in her house is astonishing. Even if she felt this strongly about Black Lives Matter, what reasonable parent would not either ask, you know, say to their son, I'm sorry, I just can't have them in the house. We need to make an excuse and, you know, have her husband take them back home, or wait until the sleepover is over and say, I'm sorry, but I'd prefer not to have him in the house again. Even if you felt that strongly, wouldn't that be a far more reasonable tack to take than to attack a 14-year-old?
You know, I'm not going to make it through the show. Let me just tell you right now. This is you know what's also, you touched on this just glancing. By the way, Laura Cromaldi wrote this story in the Boston Globe. We should give her credit.
Great reporter.
About a year or two, the Globe did reporting about these clerk magistrate hearings, which are often run by people who aren't lawyers, often held in secret. And my recollection, Andrea, correct me if I'm wrong, no state in the country allows this. This outrage, and you're right, the word is not strong enough. This woman should not be allowed to be in a position where anybody in Milton needs to call her to ask for help or protection. Let me read you a paragraph from Cromaldi's story. Clerk magistrate hearings are typically held behind closed doors, but the Globe filed an appeal last October, and the hearing was made public. What I read into that, Andrea, is had the Globe not gotten wind of this and filed this appeal, we wouldn't have even known about what happened in this clerk magistrate hearing, and might not have known about the behavior of a Milton cop who at least, I think, can credibly
Great
be called
point.
A racist. Is that, am I not right about that?
No, I don't think that we would have known. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there are, you know, lots and lots over the course of a year. There are lots and lots of, hearings that are held on these types of misdemeanor charges. They're not all, you know, as newsworthy as this one is. But yeah, had the Globe not done this, it would not have happened. But beyond,
well,
I mean, you know think about driving through Milton with a Black Lives Matter bumper sticker.
Amen.
And she's on duty. What are the chances that you'll get pulled over on a pretext or that something bad could happen? I mean, it's just, this is just insanity.
You know, Andrea Cabral, two things, just, and maybe the first one is kind of petty, but the picture of her with the baseball cap low over her eyes and the mask on, I thought, gee, you couldn't, I mean, I don't know. I guess you're allowed to come into court not being able to see who somebody is, but I thought that struck me. But the second thing is, I think we white people should really get rid of this expression, I don't see people through race.
Well, you know that anybody who says that
does.
Yeah. I mean, well,
it sees. Well, yeah. But it's just a ridiculous thing to say.
Right.
Who doesn't notice somebody is tall, somebody is short, somebody's black, somebody's Latino.
Exactly.
I mean, somebody's blonde. Of course that. I don't even know why people say that. Oh, I don't see race. Really?
Yeah.
So,
and this is,
to your
first point, she's not in a courtroom. I mean, she's not before a judge, but she is in a courtroom before a clerk magistrate. And yes, you are not allowed to wear a hat inside of a courtroom. Judges will routinely tell people to remove whatever they have on their heads, unless it's maybe a hijab or something like that. But yeah, I mean, but she clearly does not want a bunch of people to recognize her. And she, at least to the point of approaching the clerk magistrate's desk, she was allowed to keep it on. But no, I mean, it is just, you know, the I don't see race thing is the last resort of someone who is credibly being accused of doing just the opposite.
So, Andrea Cabral, you mentioned the Boogaloo Boys in passing. The other day we had Kareem Hajj on from the Frontline documentary American Insurrection. And one of the many people who was featured in this was this guy, I hope I pronounce this right, Steven Carrillo. He's an Air Force guy, I believe.
Yes.
And you wanted to talk, and I'm so glad you did, a little bit about Carrillo and the story. So take it away, if you will.
There's so much to unpack in this ProPublica story. And to your point, ProPublica, I think, hooked up with the Berkeley Investigative Journalism School and PBS and produced the Frontline documentary. And then they have a very lengthy sort of profile of Steven Carrillo and his involvement with the Boogaloo Boys in ProPublica. And I almost don't know where to start with this because it hits on so many different points. One, it profiles this particular guy, Steve Carrillo, who is an Air Force guy, actually a specialist within the security forces within the Air Force, and, you know, sort of details how he became involved in the Boogaloo Boys. For people who don't know, because it's really easy to get all of these different groups confused, the Boogaloo Boys are far-right extremists, but primarily, or largely, I won't even say primarily because there are some white supremacists and there are clearly some racists in the Boogaloo Boys, but they are primarily known for being far-right anti-government.
Right.
I would love to see the Venn diagram between the Boogaloo Boys, the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, and some of these other groups. That, you know, that spot in the middle is where you're going to find the most dangerous people, because you definitely find some diversity in the Boogaloo Boys that you don't necessarily find in some of the other groups, because they are largely focused on anti-government. Carrillo himself is the son of a Mexican immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's his and how he got drawn into that, going from sort of being a libertarian to developing this virulent anti-government and specifically anti-police ideology, to the point where he ended up ambushing police officers and killing. I think one was killed and one was wounded, or he may have killed two officers. So there's that part of it.
I think two, by the way. He killed the Oakland federal security officer Underwood, and I can't remember the name, when they came after him at his house.
Santa Cruz.
I'm pretty sure he killed somebody, another cop. Yeah, law enforcement person. But go ahead, Andrea.
And he had both bombs, you know, sort of these, you know, improvised explosive devices, and he had bought a $15 mechanism that turned his semi-automatic rifle into basically a machine gun. And he was able to do that with something he bought for $15 over the internet. But it also talks about Carrillo's background, and this is one of the parts that another Venn diagram is needed. He, I think he was given up as a toddler by his parents, and there was clearly domestic violence in his household. and that sort of overlap between, you know, people who ultimately become mass shooters or otherwise take to the streets in violent ways or against individuals in violent ways, that upbringing, what they come out of, and then their lack of introspection. I mean, the ProPublica headline is, quote, "I felt hate more than anything, how an active duty airman tried to start a civil war." And there's so much to dive into there, because he did probably feel hate more than anything, but a complete lack of introspection as to why he felt that, and more importantly, why he directed it specifically at police. So the other thing with the Boogaloo Boys that you'll find is that sometimes they align themselves with in protesting against the murder of people like George Floyd, because there's such a heavy anti-government, anti-police aspect to it. So you've seen Boogaloo Boys at a lot of these protests, and they are largely, versus Black Lives Matter members, they are largely the ones that are trying to incite the violence. So there's that. That's another aspect of it. Then it is sort of the part about how he became too extreme even for them, which is really saying something. I mean, he certainly was in touch with certain higher-ups, and depending on what faction of the Boogaloo Boys you're talking about, some of them are far more organized and have a far more concrete hierarchy of power than most people believe. People kind of like to believe these are sort of these ragtag groups of either domestic terrorists or white supremacist extremists. At least within the Boogaloo Boys, there's, and I would suggest the Oath Keepers as well, but at least with regard to the Boogaloo Boys, there's the Grizzly Scouts in California, which are very organized. And that's really who he sort of hooked in with and started this idea that he was going to start this civil war, because one of the basic tenets of the Boogaloo Boys is that there will be a second civil war that will be an anti-government insurrectionist conflict. That's what they all sort of have in common. And there are factions in, you know, many states in the country. They've largely used Facebook and other social media to really kind of come together and organize. In any event, he at some point becomes too extreme for them, even though he is clearly, there's evidence via text message and other ways that he was organizing something like this. But when they were coming for him, he was calling for the Boogaloo Boys to drop everything and rush to where he was. He identified his location, and to take all of the police officers out. Now, none of them came, which doesn't surprise me, but he did manage to ambush the officers that did come. But, you know, there are just, when you're looking at, we kind of have these generic ways we talk about this, white supremacist violence, domestic terrorism, extremist terrorism. The drill down into who has been steadily over the last, you know, decades joining these organizations and the degree to which they are linked by violence and violent ideology needs a lot more attention. When the FBI talked about this in 2009 and it was sort of downplayed, you know, think of how long ago it was, 2009, and the degree to which law enforcement members, military members,
military, right,
and others, right? People that you would never think would be attracted to this or would get involved in this, you know, sort of three-piece suit types, business executive types, men and women have been drawn into these groups is astonishing and is reaching a critical mass point. I mean, Carrillo is just one example, but I think the similarities between him, the basis for his grievance, and the way these groups draw people in, I think applies to millions of people across this country, largely due to their lack of introspection about why they actually feel the way they feel.
You know, Andrea, under Secretary Austin, there appears to be a renewed, I think we discussed this with Kareem Hajj, who was with us the other day, who was involved in the making of the film, that the Pentagon seems to be much more serious about trying to ferret out those in their own ranks who are involved in these extremist groups, but a lot of them also have law enforcement connections. Is there the same enthusiasm for identifying them and outing them in law enforcement ranks as there appears to be, or at least I hope there is, in the military now?
No, I wouldn't say that that's true at all. And it's because, you know, there are, I used to know this number, but I don't know it anymore, the total number of police departments and first responder sheriff's offices, it's hundreds and hundreds, obviously, maybe even over 1,000 in the country. And, you know, they operate largely by a community standard. There, it's not like we in this country have a federal law enforcement department that is just, you know, situated in cities and towns and states across the country. And so how people get hired, what kind of a background check is done before they're hired, I think you will start to see a lot more police departments look much more closely at social media and even, you know, hire firms that can do dark web searches to find out what the postings are, because, A, they have an interest in it, especially if someone is a member of a, you know, sympathetic to a group that wants to kill all police officers, but also because of the level of liability that they suffer when they have hired someone for whom there has not been an extensive background check, who is later found to have these kind of leanings and then acts on them.
Do you feel, Andrea?
I don't think that it's true now that they are really paying attention to it, but I think they need to.
Do you feel like you're going to explode most days? I do.
Yes. Yeah. Pretty much every single minute of every single hour.
That's sort of how I feel.
Day.
Hey, we are almost about out of time here, Andrea. But real quickly, Wright, of course, was killed by a police officer near where the Derek Chauvin trial is going on. She claims it was an accident. She didn't mean to go for her gun. She meant to go for her taser. We have stories that say trainings for cops to not mistake their gun for a taser. They're there, but they're not really effectively done. Do you buy the idea that it was an accident?
No, I don't think it was an accident. For a couple of reasons, and I sort of agree with Solomon Jones, who wrote a piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and actually Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer has written extensively about this too. It was not an accident, in my view, based upon what is known, you know, in the recitation of the facts of this case, just the idea that she had drawn her gun already and had been holding it for quite a long time. But I also think the larger point is that it was not an accident, because he never should have been pulled over to begin with.
Yeah.
So when you look at all of the extensive history, this is sort of the culmination of, at this point, the more likely than not, right? That's what makes it, in my view, from a 30,000-foot view, not an accident, because the number of times that a person of color is pulled over for something completely pretextual, inconsequential, the numbers are just staggering, and that whether that leads to a death, which happens very frequently, a beating, which also happens, or an arrest, which isn't even necessarily called for based on the basis of the stop or the fact of the stop. You look at that, and it's almost inevitable that it will turn into something bad. Now, depending on who you believe, and I don't know what the level of proof of this is going to be ultimately. When Dottie Wright called his mother, he said he was stopped because he had an air freshener hanging from his rearview mirror.
Yeah.
There is documented, there are many instances of this that are documented, and in fact, there have been courts that have upheld that a police officer can stop for an air freshener, which is insane because it hardly obstructs the person's view of their windshield. They said that they stopped him for an expired license tag, which during the pandemic especially, there are millions of people driving with expired license tags because, you know, even here, the Registry of Motor Vehicles on inspections is, you know, the software has been down and they haven't been able to even schedule any inspections. But during the pandemic, of course, you're going to have a lot more people with those smaller things, you know, unattended to. So the idea that she was training other officers that day, the idea that she would pull him over for something like that is just, police officers routinely say the traffic stops are among the most dangerous things they encounter over the course of their career. And that's a lot of the reason why they ask for so much, so many armaments, right? So many firearms, so many mechanisms of protection. Then why are you pulling over people for inconsequential things? Why are you putting yourself in that situation?
Yeah. You know, Andrea, I can quote Chuck Todd from an hour ago, who's not a law enforcement expert, and said, America needs to have serious conversations about traffic stops, and you seem to be saying the same thing, both for reasons of danger to the cop and, more importantly, to the person stopped, and in terms of resource allocation. It seems like that's a pretty decent conversation to be having, don't you think?
Right. If there's no problem with the person's driving, if the driving isn't erratic, it's not causing a potential risk to others, an expired license tag or an inspection sticker where there's no obvious problem with the way the car is running, it's not leaking dangerous oil or fuel, why do that? And that's because those kinds of stops have become pretextual, and the numbers don't lie.
Yeah, you're right.
The numbers of people of color who are stopped have, with no contraband or any other problem found, especially, versus the number of white people who are stopped, and in particular where contraband is found, are staggering. The ratio is just staggering.
By the way, before you go, just on that note, this is not traffic stop. We didn't have time for this today. But proving your point, study came out 2 days ago out of New Bedford. 7% of the population is black. 46% of the stops, frisks, and interrogations are of black people in New Bedford. So,
Andrew, thank you.
It's a much bigger conversation about who is perceived to be dangerous. And even in the Derek Chauvin trial, they kept making the case right up until the time they rested, basically, that George Floyd was a large black man who was terrifying and posed a threat long after his pulse had stopped. And there's a lot more to this and a lot more to unpack about the history of the way the country has portrayed people of color since slavery, certainly in movies like Birth of a Nation, as brutes that have to be socially controlled and put down. And so it's deeply embedded in the fabric of the country and not unique to police officers.
Andrea, thanks.
You're welcome.
Andrea Cabral joins us every week for Law and Order. She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety. She's now the CEO of Ascend. Coming up, a former employee blows the whistle on Facebook for letting fake news manipulate geopolitics. Tech writer Andy Nocco joins us for that and much more next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us to go over the latest headlines at the intersection of tech, policy, and commerce is Andy Anatko. Andy's a tech writer and blogger. You can find his work at anatko.com. You can follow him at IHNATKO. And we can actually see him on Zoom
there
for the first time.
Andy's on Zoom.
And I think 7 or 8 years. Hello there, Andy. Nice to see you.
Yes.
That's right.
My God.
Everyone's aged.
I had to shave for the first time in like a year during the show.
You look excellent. Let me tell you, you look beautiful.
Yes, everyone's aging well, very well, Andy Anatko. So President Biden has ordered this new round of economic sanctions, NPR is reporting, on Russia because of their meddling and a Kremlin-linked computer breach that penetrated some government networks. Can you tell us a little bit what this is about and whether the sanctions matter or are going to help the situation?
Yeah, hopefully they're going to matter. This is the first really big steel boot that the president of the United States has really tried to inflict against Russia. And this comes after both federal intelligence agencies as well as private digital intelligence agencies have confirmed that the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service has been running amok. They were associated with the 2016 hack of the DNC to get their emails. They were behind interference in the 2020 presidential election. And also, they were also very, very heavily involved in that big SolarWinds hack a couple of months ago that allowed it was a weakness in network software that allowed a whole bunch of people to have free reign over different servers. And once again, forensics determined that no, this was a state-sponsored state action on behalf of Russia. So this isn't the first time that there's been actions and sanctions against Russia on this sort of thing. Trump, I think, did some sort of like slapping style financial sanctions. This one tries to have a little bit more oomph to it. For one thing, 32 different individuals, like 16 individuals and 16 actual like Russian service entities have been targeted instead of just the individuals. Biden has also given Washington the power to sanction any sector of the Russian economy, and almost immediately United States institutions, banking institutions, were forbidden to operate in the Russian bond market. So that's going to hurt. They kicked diplomats out of the Russian embassy in D.C. That's traditional. And they're also actually took the extra step of, okay, well, we're so angry, but we're so insistent about this that guess what? We are also going to be sanctioning individuals that aren't associated with these hacks, but they're just associated with actions against Crimea that we don't like. So hopefully this is a very, very big sign that things are changing.
Well, but the good news is that in terms of government abuse, is that Facebook is really cracking down on governments that try to manipulate the platform against their citizens. I should clarify, they crack down unless the country in question that is manipulating the platform against their citizens is poor or non-Western. Essentially, the powerful nations are one thing, the others are another. Is that a fair characterization of the Facebook informal policy, Andy Anatko? By the way, you look beautiful, almost clean shaven. The more I look at you, the more I like it. Go ahead.
That's the MacBook M1 processor that could do all this visual processing, making me look like I haven't gained 80 pounds and lost half of my life. But yeah, this is there was a really, really brave and important series of articles published by The Guardian. They keep publishing these almost daily. A former Facebook engineer who was working in data analysis by the name of Sophie Zhang resigned from the post because she was kind of disgusted by what was going on. And she documented to The Guardian how poorly Facebook's fight against state-sponsored inauthentic behavior. We're talking about like when your political opponent you attack your political opponent by giving like a million, giving thousands of fake dislikes and fake comments purporting to be for the voices of the people, but they're actually like your campaign and your federal office that is actually engineering this. The claim overall is that Facebook is very, very slow to respond when these actions are affecting poorer countries as opposed to when they're affecting wealthier countries, and that largely this is driven by the desire not to keep their network clean, but to avoid bad PR. Enough of a bombshell just a few days ago when they started the series, but every day they are releasing more information and more stories based on what Sophie Zhang has been given them, and it really paints Facebook in a poor light. And I'm saying that relative to our understanding of how a bad light we already consider Facebook to be.
That's right. Very good point,
Andy Anatko. Almost every week when we talk to you, there's another Facebook disgraceful story. I'm just wondering, how long does this go on? I mean, at some point, are we going to say enough is enough? I mean, I know that people like our own Senator Elizabeth Warren want to get them broken up and regulated. Is this?
Well, can I answer that question instead of Andy?
Jim.
It's going to go on exactly as long as you and I keep buying from Amazon, despite bad-mouthing the business practices of Amazon every single day on the radio. Is that not right, Andy? About roughly about that same period of time?
Yeah, pretty much. The more hopeful thing, and this is why Sophie Zhang was so adamant about becoming whistleblower, is that she feels that the only way to really make this change happen is to make it from within. She did actually, separate from this Guardian series, she did an Ask Me Anything on Reddit, I think just yesterday, that was more personal. And she said that one of the reasons why she went to work at Facebook was because she didn't agree with how the company was operating itself, and she felt as though she could affect change from within. And that proved to be, unfortunately, not possible, as well as she documented it. But now, at least as a former employee, she is able to hopefully exert some more pressure on Facebook. Facebook has, of course, denied all of these allegations. It's correct to point out that some of the biggest examples that she cites, which is just the horrible manipulation in Azerbaijan and the Honduran elections, they, as a matter of fact, did take action against both of these, again, coordinated and authentic behavior campaigns. That was done in about, I think, 2019, and they actually shared this information with Twitter to help shut down those networks on Twitter, too. But the problem that she's pointing out is that it takes a very, very long time for them to do anything, and in many cases, it depends on who's being affected. There is a news story from coming out of India that Facebook allowed a network of fake accounts to artificially inflate the popularity of an MP from India's ruling party for months and months and months after being alerted to the problem. And the data that that Sophie points out is that they were moving towards, well, this is obviously, again, coordinated inauthentic behavior, meaning not just individuals doing stuff on their own, but there's a state, there's a big operation out here. And there was a point at which one of the managers said, whoa, 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 whoa. I noticed that this person's name is on a special list of, like, essentially, like, here are important people in India or our friends, people are friendly to us. Do we really want to jump forward on this? And that's going to be affecting how they do things. So that's, they have a lot to answer for it. I doubt that they're really going to try to answer for it.
Okay, we are talking to Andy Nako, our tech guy. You do have some good news for us on broadband. What's going on?
Yeah. Our complaint for the past like 3 or 4 years has been like, yes, the broadband speeds stink, and there are areas where you can't get broadband at all, and the service is terrible. And the problem has been that the FCC, particularly under its former leadership, Ajit Pai, has taken a pro-business stance, meaning they just don't care. They were accepting the information provided by the broadband providers themselves regarding, here's the speeds that we're delivering, here are the areas and communities that we're serving. Hey, everything's great. You can trust our data. And there's a big, big, big push from the FCC now to address this problem head on. And part of it is a massive program that they're putting in to actually map out internet broadband service in the United States. And they just released a really, really good tool. The FCC has created an app that runs on either the iPhone or your Android device that will actually test your broadband, either your Wi-Fi speeds or your mobile internet. And it gives a very, very fine-grained results on how fast it is, how good it is. And if you give it permission, that report will be sent directly to the FCC as they're compiling this report. You can even tell them, if you're really all in on this, you can say, by all means, test every 24 hours. Also, add my location so that you know exactly where I'm seeing the speed. So they know that my provider is Verizon or Comcast. They know where I am. They know how good the service is. So that's the first thing we need. We need hard data before we can attack the problem.
But I don't understand why you're so excited about this, frankly. In all seriousness, hard data is great, particularly when it's the alternative to self-serving data provided by the providers themselves. Who's going to download this app? I mean, it seems to me every Andy Anatko in the country will download it. Are any people who don't have your focus on these kinds of issues going to do it? And if they don't, all they're getting is random data from a self-selected group, right? Am I wrong about that?
Well, the sample group of Andy Anatkos in the United States of America used to be two, unfortunately. As of 10 years ago, it's down to one. However, the sample group of people who think they're being ripped off by broadband companies, who are angry that they're not getting the speeds they asked for, or angry that they can't get speeds that will let them have mm-hmm. their kids do remote learning while they themselves are doing Zoom calls. Those people are highly motivated to use a weapon against these. And also people like Andy Anatko, it's our responsibility to go on the radio and go to our blog and say, oh, this is great. This is great. You should go. You should try it. Not everybody will do it. But even if, honestly, even if it points out to the FCC that, let's say there's one or two regional nerds who are in a place of a terrible coverage that provide data that says, yeah, you know how the previous data set that you have provided by the cable companies were saying that, oh, yes, there's high-speed 100 megabit broadband right all around this valley. We're doing great. I say, well, no, actually, here are that's three users point. Of the 10,000. That's a nope. That's a spot that you guys need to actually address.
Good point.
You can't do nothing.
So Andy, not go
better than nothing.
We're going to talk with our listeners in a few minutes, but this new deal with Google Maps that can allow you to be environmentally correct in your driving routes, this is kind of this is, I think, before we trash that last effort, is good news with the broadband. I think this one seems like a good idea.
Let us be happy, Jim. It's okay
exactly.
to be happy about
you have to
things.
Ruin
I
everything.
I like this one, Andy. Actually, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, this is a great idea. So Google Maps, normally when you ask for directions, it factors in a lot of things, but usually it's mostly what's the shortest route, what's going to be the least trouble for you. But recently, the National Renewable Energy Lab came up with a piece of software that can estimate the amount of energy that will be used by an unknown arbitrary vehicle on a certain route, given just elevation changes and stuff like that. So Google is actually incorporating this tool into Google Directions now. So when you ask for directions, in addition to all the other factors it's going to calculate, it's also going to figure out, well, how much energy is going to be used? What's going to be the carbon effect of you driving along this route versus another one? It's also going to include things like the amount of time you're going to spend like in stop and go traffic, all that other stuff. And if it finds a route that's more eco-friendly that really isn't any longer it doesn't take you any more time than any other route, it's going to recommend the eco-friendly route. And this is just like step one towards a bunch of features, changes they're making to Google Directions that will hopefully get you thinking about ways to do things that are maybe more eco-friendly.
So let me be a nattering nabob of negativism for a second, even though I love this thing. We were talking to somebody you may know. Do you know who LaTanya Sweeney is? Who is at Harvard, Andy, and she's huge in the sort of in the not just the cyber world, but particularly focused on things like racism and others and algorithms and that sort of thing. And
I've never met her, but I'm a big fan.
She was terrific, and she was with us the other day. She's featured in a Nova documentary, a short that aired actually last night about. The example that she picked, by the way, is when she was talking to, I think, a reporter, and they wanted to pull up one of her own reports. She typed in her name, LaTanya.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, it came up with all, virtually everything was about porn and that sort of thing, because it's a black name, as she called it. She then typed in Tanya, and totally different things, a traditionally white name, and then she did a lot of research on it. So the negativism here, even though I love this idea.
And arrests, Jim. Remember that was the thing?
Arrests, right, exactly. Arrests and porn, all that sort of stuff. You're right. Why should we not worry that Google will manipulate this too, in the name of ecological friendliness, will actually have people buy routes that they say are environmentally friendly, but actually favor certain advertisers or others and take you on that route? Am I going too far there or no?
No, that's something we all should definitely be aware of, particularly because I do believe that our perceptions in general have been widened by accessibility to digital services, because we can, instead of just buying an area map and sort of going by how this was laid out in 1978, I can travel the streets of places. Oh my God, I didn't know there was a trailhead here. So I think it's basically good. But we have to, the thing that that must never leave our minds is that our perception of the world is now being created through this one service, Google Maps, mm-hmm. because it's so pervasive and because it's so good. Now, I think that Google has established a really, really good track record in making sure that they're not owned by you know, Rupert Murdoch types or any of these other characters are trying to like change the world, world's politics or social things. I think that they just want to create the best tool for people. But as you pointed out, and as other really great book, there's a really great book called Algorithms of Oppression by Sophia Umojo-Noble that really puts this into clarity that sometimes there isn't an intentional bias or intentional racism in a tool that works really, really well on the whole. However, we need to screen these things against incidental racism that, as you say, if you do a search for, what seems to be an African-American name or a black girl's, it's just porn, porn, porn. And it's not because Google is trying to inflate those things. It's because it is looking for words that are associated with websites that are being linked to by all kinds of other websites. So this is why ethical computing is such a broad and exciting topic right now, because it has to factor in. I know this is working well, but it's not working well for everybody. So we have to manage these search results to make sure that we're not creating a picture of the world that hurts people. And Google is much more likely to take up.
Yeah, Andrew, not go. I just have a pragmatic question about this before you go. You mentioned that, you know, elevation changes in terms of like reducing your carbon footprint and stuff, amount of stop and go traffic. But I would also assume there'd be things like red lights or stop signs or, you know, all that, the stopping and going that you do. I mean, how do you figure out, I guess is what I'm asking you, what's the carbon, least carbon footprint route?
Well, first you ask the smarter people than me at the National Renewable Energy Lab. They spend years. Google is actually investing a lot of money into testing out this piece of software they wrote to actually validate it, because they're in that position. But like I said, they really have some good ideas here. Another thing they're doing later this year is that right now, if you ask for directions, you get like car driving directions. But if you want to find out how to get there via public transportation or by biking or by walking, You can tap a button and it'll change those results to give you that. So what they're going to do now is that they're going to actually include public transportation and give it sort of like parity with the car information, so that it actually takes me only about 5 or 10 minutes longer to travel to the WGBH studios. God, hopefully we'll be able to meet there sometime soon. But it only takes a little bit longer for me to travel there by public transportation than by car. But imagine that I didn't know this. Imagine that I'm just looking for car direction. I'm like, oh God, it's Storrow Drive. I have to find a place to park. It's going to be an hour. But then it tells me, oh, actually, if you just drive like 5 miles, or better yet, take your bicycle to this commuter rail station, it will get you there only 10 minutes later. And you can spend that time drinking coffee and reading a book instead of urban mechanized warfare.
I love that line, urban mechanized warfare.
Andy, it's good to see you.
Thank you very
much. Thanks so much.
Good to see you guys.
Nice to actually see you. Andy Natko joins us regularly. He's a tech writer and blogger. You can find his work at anatko.com, and you can follow him at Anatko. That is IHN as in Nancy, ATK as in Kleenex, O. Coming up, are online schools here to stay? Paul Revel joins us for that conversation and other education headlines. Paul Revel is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, joining us online to talk through all the ways that COVID has changed education, both momentarily and fundamentally, as former State Secretary of Education, that'd be Paul Revel. Paul's a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, it's co-authored with Lynn Sachs, is Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, A Practical Guide for School and Community Leaders. Wow. Hello there, Paul. How are you?
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. I'm just great. How are you?
Very well. Good to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, Paul. So a lot of fascinating stories about what the pandemic is going to mean for education. Let's start with the one the New York Times reported about how online virtual schooling could be here to stay when this disaster is all done, this pandemic, that is. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's an interesting phenomenon developing that was not a total surprise, because we talked about this at some points earlier, that maybe once some families and some students were bumped out of schools, they'd find other ways and means of educating themselves, and they might take to that, and some of them might actually wind up preferring. Well, it turns out that, in fact, a certain amount of that is happening. Now, how much we don't know, but there any number of reports from students themselves and from families that their particular child learns more easily in this kind of a fashion due to special needs, due to just their own kind of personality and disposition, due to their anxieties about going out to school. And so an increasing number of school districts are actually taking the initiative to launch virtual schools and to provide a virtual option to people, not just this year in the midst of this crisis where a lot of schools are still struggling to get back in person, but in the long run. They intend to set up and sustain virtual schools that will give parents the option, should they want, you know, to have their children learn from home. And this is more widespread than expected now. We had a lot of talk about would pandemic pods persist and things of that nature, and there's less evidence that those are going to continue and more evidence now that the school systems are really finding parental demand for this kind of option at a level that's higher than was originally expected.
Well, you know, when I read this story, I have a perfect, you don't know this, Paul, but I have a perfect attendance record at my reunions from my high school in Durfee High School in Fall River.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. I love them. They're always really fun. But one of the things I realize is that kids can be really mean, especially when they're little, you know, there are kids there that had a terrible time in school. They focused on this one, a kid, this Roy Levin kid, who apparently has been ridiculed and ostracized and given a hard time in school because he's different. And that happens so much. And then you realize that lots of people happily do outgrow this, you know, but if you didn't have to go through that horrible trauma of being the subject of bullying in school, because you can learn at home and you're a really good student, that seems to make a lot of sense to me. You don't want to see anybody ostracized. But on the other hand, if you're dealing with that every day, you know, and you can be home and not deal with it every day, I don't know. It seems
Isn't it enabling the ostracism?
You know, that's part of what you worry about, is that it sort of normalizes the idea that certain people can be pushed out.
Yeah.
You know, a larger worry in equity dimensions is, you know, some people feel as though this will lead to the further balkanization of education. You know, it will be fragmented, and particularly those who have privilege and good circumstances for learning at home will withdraw from the public endeavor of public education and will not only lose their participation and support, but will also lose the kind of socializing function of education to the degree that we have somewhat integrated school systems, which we don't in a lot of places. But there's the idea that, you know, the social function of education is to help children learn to interact with one another, to disagree agreeably, to make common cause with their peers, to have fun together, to build relationships. And if we make it sort of highly individualized and everybody's doing their own thing, there are risks and downsides, but there are obviously positive features that if were you a parent and you had a child who really needed this or could use it, you could hardly blame that parent for saying, let's demand that the school system provide this now that we know we can do it.
Talking to Paul Revel, former Secretary of Education, you know, a lot of people, as you say, hope that trend online virtual schools continues. One trend I assume most of us hope won't continue is apparently there are far fewer applicants for teachers, for education degrees and master's degrees in education. And while when I started to read the story this morning, I was hoping it was just a function of the fact that obviously it's a scary time for teachers, I went on to read that the trend continued, as you've told us, of course, pre-pandemic, and the fears of a lot of experts like you, I don't know if it includes you, is the trend is going to continue even post-pandemic. So are teacher shortages a crisis in the making here, or is this just a pandemic drop?
No, and it's a big worry. And before I go to that, let me just one last point on the last story.
Sure.
Which is the history of virtual schools has been there are a lot of large national curriculum providers who have offered distance learning via the Internet, and the track record on those has not been good.
Mm.
So there's lots of reasons for schools to be cautious in adopting some of these national programs. The one of the, I think, most attractive features of some of the things that we're seeing now is that school systems, given their experience with the technology, are mounting their own programs taught by their own teachers in their own particular way. And I think that's the way to go on this. As far as the teacher shortages go, we have, because of large numbers of baby boomers retiring, we already have a pinch in a lot of fields in education. It's very difficult for certain subject areas or for certain kinds of, for example, special needs or English language learners. Many districts struggle to find qualified people to take those jobs. We've always had a very high attrition rate in education, and many of us have felt that if we could just stem the attrition, we wouldn't have anywhere near the need to hire so many people each year. I think the current attrition rate now is about 8%. So, you're losing close to a tenth of the profession each year. And that means that we haven't created an attractive, sustaining profession for a lot of people. Those rates are even higher in the earlier years, in the one to seven years of service in the field. And so we have to think deeply about whether or not we've created the teaching profession that is going to draw the most talented people in our society and is going to hold them. And I think the answer is, for the most part, in many places, we've not been able to do that. So we've got to work simultaneously on, building a profession that's attractive and then reaching out and recruiting, particularly teachers of color, where we've got such disproportionate levels in most of our cities. For example, between the demographics of the students and the demographics of the teachers. So we've got a lot of work to do in terms of the most important ingredient in education is teachers. We spend 80% of our budgets on teachers, and right now we're a little out of sync, and the pandemic is, as with a number of other equity concerns, the pandemic is making things worse.
So how do you make it more attractive, Paul Revel? What do you do that you're not doing already?
Well, in some places, and it depends what place you're talking about. A lot of this is very context specific. You got to pay teachers more, and you've got to give them more prerogatives and benefits. You can't be sort of producing teacher-proof curriculum and acting as though teachers are factory workers who just have to put a program in a computer and line it up and do it the way the program says to do it. Teachers are professionals. They want professional discretion. They need time. They need more time. Now, this is a function also of negotiations between administrations and unions relative to how teachers spend their days. But teachers need more time for planning and for collaborating with one another. They need students getting more support and help on issues that they bring into school with them that frequently get in the way of classroom teachers being able to to focus and concentrate and have everybody engaged in their instruction. We need to give them more recognition for the service that they do, more appreciation, more status ultimately in society for going into the world of teaching. And, particularly in these times, teachers have been frontline workers and have had to make incredible adaptations for those who have gone in and served in schools. And it's been a very difficult period. And I think they need rewards and recognition for having done that and encouragement to make the adaptations as a profession going forward. So, there's a lot of work to do to make it appealing, but I think we've got to start thinking about that, and that means some policy changes.
We're talking to Paul Revel, former Secretary of Education, now at Harvard.
Paul Revel, the Globe has got a headline about the pandemic upending college admissions, with both more surprises and more waitlists. What's the bottom line here?
Well, I mean, it's a very different year in terms of college admissions. I mean, the many schools have been moving in the direction of test optional or not asking for test scores at all. But that number grew substantially larger as a result of the pandemic because testing centers couldn't open, people couldn't get there. And so a number of schools saw an opening to experiment with something that they've wanted to do anyway, which was to disregard the test because there's a lot of doubt about the predictive power of those tests to show whether or not people will do well in college. And so when it's a grades-only situation, you're getting far more non-traditional students applying. You're getting far more students who would have thought because of test scores they couldn't get into an institution, for example, an Ivy League institution, and now they're thinking, based on my grades, I might be able to get in. And sure enough, they're right. And we find a number of these institutions admitting much higher levels of students of color, for example, or economically disadvantaged students than they have been before. So your prospects for getting into these schools coming from some of those subgroups that historically have been disadvantaged in Ivy League admissions and elite school admissions are now getting in. Conversely, on the other side of the equation, some people who thought they would get admission to some of the more selective schools are finding out that they're on wait lists or they're not accepted at all. And naturally, they're disappointed by that and surprised by it because they thought, well, such and such school was a good fallback for me, or I've done well my whole career educationally, and I thought I could get in here, but now I'm not. So there's a lot of disruption and uncertainty. Wait lists are growing. Colleges are admitting more students because they're not sure how many are going to come once they get an offer of admission, and they may have to go to the wait list. So there's a lot of uncertainty among students relative to where they're going to go to school because they may have been waitlisted at the school they really want to go to but accepted at another school, and the deadline's coming up and they're going to have to make up their mind. So it's a shake-up time, but it's also an experimental time in the field. I applaud the schools who are electing not just to do this for a single year, but they're thinking about doing it for 2 or 3 years so that they can see how these new candidates who they've accepted for admission do when they arrive at school, how they persist, what kind of support and assistance various students are going to need to successfully move through the process. But the overall trend, I think, is one toward diversifying, toward doing a better job on equity than many of our elite institutions have done historically. So I think it's a promising trend, but it's going to need a closer look over a few years.
When you say a promising trend, you don't just mean in terms of the end product, meaning who's admitted. Do you also mean the declining reliance on standardized testing? And if it is what you mean, well, whether it's what you mean or not, is that going to continue?
Well, I think it's interrelated. I mean, the reliance on standardized tests has created a barrier. I'm an advocate for certain forms of standardized testing for certain purposes, for example, diagnostic purposes. But as a sort of absolute gatekeeper on admissions, it's really not the way testing should be used. And we've got enough evidence to suggest, you know, that the predictive power, again, of these tests for showing you who's going to do well is not as strong as the predictive power of grades. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, the jury's still out on some of these questions. And this is a large-scale live experiment. We're going to have an opportunity to look at what makes a difference here, and that's why I'm glad a number of institutions are doing it. It'll give us more data and evidence on which to make a more a fairer, mm-hmm. more equitable kind of admissions policies in the future.
So, Paul Brevard, education man, the Globe is reporting that just 35% of Asian American public school students were likely going to go back to school full time on April 26th. The school department has put this data together. That's far fewer than Black and Latino kids. That's about 60%, 72% of white kids. What is going on here?
Well, I think there are a couple of things going on. I mean, it's a somewhat alarming trend, but on the other hand, things do change. I mean, the numbers for Black and Latinx students in terms of the family's willingness to have them come back to school were not too long ago far lower than they are now. So those numbers have changed and gone up. I think you've got a couple of factors with respect to Asian American students, Asian students, Pacific Islanders. In particular, obviously, the violence that happened, the shootings in Atlanta, the general increase in bullying and negative behavior toward Asian Americans is the factor that parents are worried about. It was something that existed prior to the pandemic, and in many areas of the country, it seems to have worsened now. And that's coupled with fears in many of these families about the viruses. Now, folks in Asia have experienced with MERS and SARS much closer contact with the impact of a virus like the one we're experiencing right now, and may tend to be more cautious than some other groups about coming together in large groups where, you know, behavior is somewhat less moderated than it is, you know, in schools. You've got recess, you've got people on buses, you've got people riding public transportation to school and things of this nature. So I think there's a kind of a cautiousness coupled with a fear of bullying, and that's contributing to those numbers being low. I'm hopeful that once school actually returns in person and, you know, the stories begin to seep out that some of those worries are not justified in the current circumstances, that students can be safe both physically from bullying and that the numbers continue to stay down in terms of the transmission of the virus in school settings, that we'll see a change in that before too long. At least I'm hopeful of that.
I hope so, too, because as Marjorie said, 35%, that is really a shocking and scary kind of number.
Huge. Yeah.
And there's no question those parents want their children to come back. I mean, every bit as much as other parents, and I think Asian American parents believe that, you know, the best learning situation is going to be an in-person learning situation. They want to get back to that as soon as possible. So I think it's up to folks in school systems and to the society generally to provide every assurance and as much evidence as we can produce that it will be safe for their children to go back.
Paul, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to both of you.
Hey, thank you very much, Paul.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Paul Breville joins us regularly. He's the former State Secretary of Education. He's a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Lynn Sachs, is Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, a Practical Guide for School and Community Leaders. Paul Breville, thank you very much. Coming up, Boston Globe investigative reporter Andrew Ryan joins us to talk about retired police officer Patrick Rose and the blue wall of silence that protected him from charges of sexual abuse for two decades. That is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. She's Marjorie Egan. I am Jim Browdy. Patrick Rose, a retired police officer and the one-time president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, was charged last year with sexually abusing multiple children. As disturbing as this is, to have a cop exploiting the very trust that comes with a job of protecting us, what's even more dismaying is that many of these abuses could have been prevented. That's because Rose, in 1995, was charged with sexually assaulting a 12-year-old boy. Though the case was ultimately dropped, that same year, a subsequent internal affairs investigation and an investigation by the state's Child Welfare Agency found evidence that Rose had probably committed a crime. The Boston Globe broke this enraging and hugely important story earlier this week. Investigative reporter Andrew Ryan joins us on the line to talk about what we know so far about the police culture that protected Rose and the actions the city is now taking to get to the bottom of this. Andrew, it's really good to have you, and you're an incredible story. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, ditto, Andrew. Congratulations to you and your colleagues at the Globe who did this great reporting. Jim mentioned how dismaying it was that many of these abuses could have been prevented. So in addition to this 12-year-old boy, there were other alleged victims, including an incredible twist involving this 12-year-old boy. So before we find out how this ever was allowed to happen, tell us about these other children.
Well, I mean, I want to say that obviously any victims of sexual assault, particularly children, I mean, your heart goes out to them, because it's, you know, obviously one of the most horrific crimes it's unimaginable. You know, in this case, I don't want to say much about the victims because, you know, we want to be very careful not to reveal identities, or, you know, as the DA put out a statement earlier this week that they, you know, are feeling very exposed at the moment. You know, what we did report was that, you know, that in August that there was a young woman who came forward to police, and that her father was had been originally abused back in the 90s. I mean, what we tried to do was really look at how the institution handled this. And it's something that we've been digging into the internal affairs system in the department for several months now. Building on that previous work.
There were six more people that have come forward, right, since August? In August?
There's a total.
Plus there was a 12-year-old boy's parent. Just explain that to people that don't get that. The 12-year-old boy back in 1995, and then that boy as a parent.
Correct. And that is all, I mean, to be clear, in total, there are six victims that have come forward right now. And that includes the child from back in 1995.
You know, Andrew, Ryan, I said it at the top. This is one of the most enraging stories I think I've ever read. And I'm a hyperbolic guy, but I'm not being hyperbolic here. The new trend, we were talking to your boss about this, Brian McGrory, a couple of weeks ago. The new trend, particularly when it comes to police, whether it's state police or police in Boston, is they don't talk to the Globe reporters when they uncover misconduct, either put out a statement or they don't. And I don't think virtually any of them talk to you here. Do we have any idea who actually did know as far back as 95 and in subsequent years what Rose apparently had done and chose not to share with the public and chose not to take Rose off the streets?
I mean, that's been the focus of our reporting. I mean, we have some names who have handled the case. We know who handled the criminal case. We know who the lead investigator was on the internal affairs case. Generally, though, when these cases work their way up through the chain of command, there's a series of people who sign off on them. And they've given us a couple of names, but it's not a complete list, we don't think. And that's why we push so hard for the records, because what we want to see is how the department handled it.
I want to be clear, though, but of the names you do have, correct me if I'm wrong, none of them have been willing to speak to you. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
And I believe that Bill Evans, who was the police commissioner just up until a couple of years ago, he has said he wasn't aware of this. But his brother, Paul Evans, who was the police commissioner at the time, has declined to comment.
Correct. Correct.
And from your reporting, we've learned that former Mayor Marty Walsh refused to release these documents. Has he explained why he did that?
His administration and the department, they cited a law that protects the identities of victims of sexual assault and domestic violence. But what they did when they cited that, they didn't, you know, redact documents. They said, you can't have this entire file. And so what we have pushed for is we said, you know, redact the documents, you know, protect the identities, but we want to see how the institution handled it. And up until, you know, we had gone back and forth and appealed to the Secretary of State's office, who said that the administration didn't meet its threshold for withholding the documents. But it wasn't until the story came out Sunday. And then obviously now we have Acting Mayor Janey, and Acting Mayor Janey made a different decision.
Yeah. By the way, it's been, I'm sure your experience and certainly mine when I was a reporter doing DCF stories that, you know, protecting the identities of the children, that was the excuse that was often given, really had nothing to do with the identities of the children, because you didn't identify the children. It had to do with what the adult failures. And that seems to be exactly what is going on here. It's not about revealing details of these kids.
Because they can redact whatever would
exactly
identify the kid, obviously.
I mean, that's not really a legit excuse, is it, in this case?
I mean, we've heard this. They've cited this law, you know, a dozen times to us in the last 6 months for a reason to withhold an entire file. And again, we're talking about something that would show, I mean, certainly would detail the details of what's alleged, but what we were, you know, just as interested in was, you know, how the institution handled these different cases. The other cases were more often domestic violence. But still, we, you know, that's one of the things that we've pushed for, is that we want to see how the how the department handled these things as an institution, and how an employer treated an employee who's accused of these things.
Jim and I have a little technical difficulty, so I apologize if we're talking over each other a little bit. But I just want to be clear about one thing, because I don't think we were, Andrew. The child that alleged the molestation in 1995 came back many years later as a grown-up to say his own child had been abused by the same cop. Am I correct about that?
That's correct. And I want to be, I don't want to go too,
we don't have to go any further. Right. That alone is really, I think, quite informing of people, that it's just incredible, a two-generational kind of thing. I also want to know about Department of Children and Families that used to be DSS at the time. And again, correct me if I'm wrong, but they are mandated report. They investigate child abuse cases, but I don't understand how they can find that there was probably abuse here and then kind of let it go. I mean, if there was a crime committed, weren't they obligated, if it was a police officer involved, to go beyond the police, perhaps to the district attorney's office, to do something about this?
Well, to be clear, that there was a criminal charge that was filed. So in 1995, the BPD sexual assault unit filed a single criminal charge against Rose, who was then a rookie patrolman. We know that DSS also did an investigation. Now, they work with a lower burden of proof. And so the language they use is that the allegation was supported. The DSS, which is now the Department of Children and Families, they wouldn't confirm or deny that, because they have pretty strict confidentiality rules, you know, in part because, you know, when they support allegations, it's a lower burden of proof. It's not the same reasonable doubt that we're used to in criminal cases. And so what happened was, we know that there was a criminal charge filed. We know that that case was ultimately dismissed when the child recanted, allegedly because he was pressured by Rose. Okay. We know DSS supported allegations, and we know that then after the criminal charge was dismissed, that the Internal Affairs unit looked at it and they sustained the case.
You know, Andrew Ryan, on the DCF front, or the DSS front, as it used to be called, again, Marjorie did a lot of reporting in her Herald, and I guess to some degree in her Globe days. And I know you and your colleague were writing about this the other day. I don't understand the confidentiality, the basis for the non-disclosure, if, once again, any identifying information on the child is kept private. I know this is probably not your area of expertise, but what is the defense to not disclose what they did and with whom they spoke, as long as they don't out the kid?
You are correct that this is not my area of expertise. So Marjorie may know better than I. But
I,
go ahead, Andrew.
I'm just suspicious. Let me just say that, Andrew. I'm suspicious of it. I mean, obviously it's legit in some cases, but I think in many cases it's not legit. It's a way to cover tracks of the adults who made mistakes. But anyway,
finish your thought, Andrew, if you would.
I mean, I do think, and this gets a little technical, and I'm not a lawyer either, but I think the burden of proof matters here, too, that, you know, in terms of, you know, that, you know, a criminal case, it's the highest reasonable doubt, which is like 90%. With the IAD case, the burden of proof is more than likely, which means 50%, 51%. And then with the DSS, with the child welfare case, it's even lower than that. So I think that could come into play as well. You know, and I would assume it's part of out of an abundance of caution to, you know, help protect children, right? That they don't set such a high threshold so they can move in and you know, protect children. Right. But again,
but
this is not my...
If I can interrupt you here, let me just say, I am a lawyer, but this, not only am I not a very good one, this is not my area of expertise either. The reality is, if there was disclosure, I don't want to belabor this, as long as they disclose to the public with the information what the standard that is applied in the case of a Patrick Rose is known, so that people don't think it's beyond a reasonable doubt, whatever it is. My sense is that I'm with Marjorie on this, based just on common sense, that it's more about protecting the adult. You know, can we step back from one of the reasons this is so enraging, beyond the fact that it was perfectly fine to allow Rose to prowl the streets, and as you've reported in at least a number of situations, and I'm sure there are many more, had intimate, at least work involvement. We don't know how much further with young kids, which is just unconscionable to me. It's pretty obvious that we are dealing with a police department that is convinced the public has no right to know anything, and a police department that is supported historically by the mayor's office. I'll just give you a couple of examples, and if you think I'm overstating it, I hope you'll tell me. There's Dennis White, the commissioner for a day, who was put on leave after appointed by Mayor Walsh when it was reported yet again that there had been some domestic abuse reports. I think it was in the late 1990s, 20 plus years ago. There was an internal affairs investigation there. It was refused to be released, even though whatever the name of the statewide person, the overseer of public records, said there was no reason not to do it. Another cop that comes to mind when Marjorie and I were talking about your coming on earlier this morning is the guy McHale, who we learned during the protest was caught on tape saying that proudly that he had driven his vehicle, as he calls it, into a protester. And then we learned once again, thanks to the Globe, that in the past, I think it was in 2005, he sexually assaulted a woman while she was intoxicated in his police car. He was put on administrative leave for the language about running his car in a protester. Do you have any idea if he's still on administrative leave? Is he back on the force? What's going on with Dennis White? I mean, we could go down this list endlessly, but they protect their own. And as Adrian Walker brilliantly and simply said in his column about your reporting the other day, what does it take to fire a cop in Boston? To which I would say, what does it take to let the public know what's going on with the cops in Boston? There is a culture of secrecy that is reinforced by the mayor's office. Is there not?
No, I think that's true. I think that they're very reluctant to give up records. I mean, I didn't specifically write about the McHale case, you know, so I don't know that one as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so I believe those were allegations, you know, but again, I didn't specifically write about that one. The Dennis,
well, by the way, the sexual, if I may, from the Globe reporting, one of your colleagues, my recollection is he actually had an unpaid leave of absence for a year. So I don't know if that caused it to rise above allegation, but obviously they took action against him for that sexual assault. I think I'm right about that, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, the Dennis White case, I mean, so this is all built on, you know, we have been collecting public records, you know, and working, you know, building on some of the work of our colleagues, you know, folks like Todd Wallach and Matt Rosselow. And, you know, so we have developed our own kind of in-house database where we can go and, you know, look folks up. And so that's what we did when Commissioner White was named, was we just ran his name through our spreadsheet.
Right.
And we know that there's a specific charge that raises a red flag. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean it's something bad, but it's something that we definitely want to dig into more. And that happened in his case. And so we then, you know, dug through the courts, and I found the records and we wrote about it, and he was immediately put on leave. But the department then refused to release the records because they said, well, since he's now on leave, we're investigating. So it's, again, part of an ongoing investigation. I mean, and some of these records are from 1993.
By the way, can I just add to that, if I may, is we asked Kim Janey last Thursday, I think, on our show, if she would release those internal affairs documents, records. And unlike the situation in the Patrick Rose case, where the pressure became immense, it, frankly, even across the country, people like Castro, were one of the Castros, were, as you know, tweeting about it, she wouldn't commit to it. She said she would look further into it, examine the records, but would not commit to releasing those, the Dennis White documents, even though once again, the state overseer of public records said there was no reason not to disclose this stuff?
Well, I mean, the state overseer of public records, what they've said is that basically the city hasn't met its threshold to mm-hmm. hold them yet. So they didn't give us a full ruling forcing them to release. They said, you haven't met the burden yet. Mm. I mean, District Attorney Rollins addressed this issue in a statement that I believe came out Tuesday when she talked about kind of the balance between protecting the privacy of the victims versus the public's right to know how BPD handled this case. And, you know, she said it pretty eloquently and acknowledged that there was a tension between those two things. And so I think that's where we are. But, you know, again, you know, for our purposes, what we're interested in is how the institution handled it, who mm-hmm. approved it, who signed off on it, and how, I mean, less than 3 years after this internal affairs case was decided, you know, he was dispatched to respond to a 14-year-old girl who was crying that she had been sexually assaulted. I mean, it seemed like there were no prohibitions put up at all in terms of restricting, you know, who he had contact with.
You know, Andrew, you're a reporter, so maybe I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here. But the Globe has done a lot of great stuff, including this piece earlier in the week by Emma Platoff on Massachusetts lawmakers and their transparency procedures. Sorry. We are an incredibly closed up state, whether it's the cops or in Boston, or whether it's the legislature, or whether it's the governor's office or the judges. And it's so surprising when you read about states like Florida, which you think are not progressive in so many ways. Yet if you're a reporter there, I guess you work at the Miami Herald, you can go in and get millions of things that we can't get in Massachusetts. This is I'm basically wondering whether you think, based on your reporting and the Globe's reporting, that maybe we're about to have some kind of sea change here because there's so much secrecy going on at every level of government in Massachusetts.
I mean, you are speaking about something very dear to my heart. I did work as a reporter in Florida.
You did?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
It's essentially like working in another country.
Do tell.
Massachusetts in particular is extraordinarily closed when it comes to public records. And it all comes from the legislature, but the governor is also complicit. They both,
yep.
I mean, the legislature exempted itself from the public records laws. The courts are not subject to the public records laws, the court system. So it can be really scattershot what you can actually get here. Just even the difference between, you know, municipal government and state government, you know, I could always, when I was covered City Hall, I could FOIA, you know, Marty Walsh's personal schedule, but I couldn't get a single thing out of the most lowly state rep because they were exempt from the public records law. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's not in the interest of the people who make the laws to make themselves subject to it.
Well, having said that, though, Andrew, I want to caution
Matt Gaetz,
the wonderful
Jim,
work.
In
can
Florida.
I just stay on this for a second? The brilliant yes. work your former colleague Todd Wallach did about
yes.
us. You say it's not in the interests of public officials. Public officials in 49 other states have decided there'll be fuller disclosure than in the liberal open state of Massachusetts, according to Todd's reporting and subsequent Globe reporting. We're the only state in America that exempts the judiciary, the legislative branch, and the executive from this sort of public disclosure. But we don't want to take any more time. I just want to say one last thing, and this is sort of an editorial. The thing that is so, and once again, congratulations. You've done such a huge public service. It's spectacular. And if the Globe in general doesn't stay on top of these things, nothing is disclosed. When I read your story the other day, I'm saying to myself, there's already enough mistrust of the police, particularly in communities of color and low-income communities in the city. How can a person be expected to trust that the police who are there to protect them might not be somebody for whom they may need protection? Meaning, if you've got a kid who's got some problems, who's 12 years old. After reading your story, I'm not putting you in the spot on this. I guess I'm just sort of venting. How do you decide whether to call the cops for fear that either Patrick Rose, not anymore, is going to come? And I guess my question then is, how do we know that there aren't 100 more Patrick Roses within the police department We don't, do we?
I mean, I guess I would say this. You know, obviously, it's a big department, and there's a lot of good officers who work very hard. And there's a lot of officers who, you know, put their lives on the line. There's no question about that. You know, and I think this is a moment where we are, you know, across the country. But there's also an issue of when things are handled in-house, when there's not full disclosure in terms of how folks are disciplined, you know, so what can happen is, you know, officers who misbehave or are guilty of misconduct can tarnish the ones exactly. who work so hard. And that's the problem because it's a big force. And, you know, there's a lot of officers who do very good work and who don't, you know, don't get in serious trouble. But, you know, I think that the institution's instincts are to protect itself. And I think that's where it becomes problematic.
Andrew, congratulations and thanks for the work you're doing. And I know I speak for everybody listening to the show, too.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Andrew. And congratulations to you and your colleagues.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
I hope you get to the bottom of this. Thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Andrew Ryan is an investigative reporter with the Boston Globe. We thank him again for taking the time to join us. Coming up, Google's mapping out a path to sustainability. We're taking your calls and asking you, would you take the road less traveled if it's also the road with fewer carbon emissions? That's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browder. Google may literally be mapping out a road to sustainability. As we discussed with Andy Notko a bit ago, later this year, the tech giant will highlight routes that deliver the lowest carbon footprint by using traffic data, road inclines, that sort of thing. When you activate the app, it will automatically default to the eco-friendly option. This will force all of us to use this app to make a choice between sustainability, speed, cost. Later this year, the app will even be more sophisticated, apparently, by letting us compare the sustainability of driving, biking, or using public transportation. So we're taking your calls at 877-301-8970. Is this the app you've been waiting for, or would this literally be a guilt trip? Do you need to be burdened with yet another moral dilemma? Do you take the fastest route to work or the most sustainable route, even if it meant that it would take more time? 877-301-8970. You love this. Am I correct about that?
I do love this. I think it's great. You know, one of the most fun things about Google Maps or Waze that I've used in my car before is that it often takes you in places you've never been, mm-hmm. Through neighborhoods you've never been to. So that's really kind of fun. You know, back roads and what do they call it on Chronicle? Back roads and back streets, or back streets and back roads, whatever it is. Places.
I know what you mean.
So I just love that idea. And obviously, if you can have not do so much damage to the environment at the same time, it's absolutely wonderful. I mean, I think it's probably not good for anything that we sit in the Southeast Expressway. Have you noticed how traffic's coming back now?
I have.
We're going to back to pre-pandemic traffic. So yeah, I think it's fantastic. I love it.
So would you, if it turns out your average route, I'm making up a number, but your average route would increase in terms of time to do it by, let's say, I don't know, 20%. Would you still choose the sustainable route?
It's saying it's going to do something the default is going to be route that's about the same time. It's not going to be
longer. Yeah, but
I'm
saying, but that one's not a tough choice. Let's assume it took a little bit longer.
If I weren't in a hurry, I routinely, you know, I go down all the time to see my sister on the Cape, mm-hmm. but I routinely get off the highway and to drive down 6A because it's so much prettier and so much nicer than sitting on the Mid-Cape Highway, especially if there's traffic. So, yeah, I think a lot of people would do that.
I agree with you, actually. 877-301-8970. Would you do this? And again, the true test is not would you pick the ecologically friendly route versus the non-ecologically friendly route. If it took the same amount of time, if it took more time, would you do it? That is what shows the commitment. Marjorie says emphatically, if she was not in a rush, even though she does drive about 85 miles an hour, trust me,
well,
I've been there.
Jim is the slowest driver. Jim drives like a grandmother, so anyone compared to him would be driving like a maniac.
That may be true. Let's start in Everett with Shane. Shane, you're on Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browder. Hi.
So So back to lie number three. If you had just read the last, the poll.
Okay. That was a pleasure. Thank you very much. Shane is called under three different names today to bore us to tears. But thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
He's on a crusade, Jim.
He's relentless. Yeah, he is.
He's on a crusade.
Okay, 877-301-8897. I start the day aggravated. Shane or Brad or whoever he is going to guarantee that I end the day aggravated. But we'll take the rest of your calls, which hopefully will not aggravate me in a minute. You have a big smile on your face. You're totally into this.
That Shane keeps calling over and over again? You mean?
No, about this ecologically friendly under Google directions.
I am, as I've said a million times, even though I am not perfect in my environmental efforts by any means, and I buy things from Amazon and I shouldn't do that, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But I mean, I am really concerned that we are going to, we are getting approaching the point of no return on the climate. So I think anything you can do, look at the front page of the Globe today. The National Guard wants to chop down all these trees down the Cape so they can be bigger shooting range.
That.
It's terrible. Yeah, by great story by David Abel, who does great environmental stuff for the Globe. You know, they're already facing problems with the water down there. The military didn't clean up with the mess they made before. Now they want to make an even bigger mess. I mean, it's just it's bizarre that that our politicians and people are so far behind where we're at in terms of climate. So yeah, if people can take a route that causes less pollution, less gas consumption, why not do it? It's not, unless you're in a real mad rush, and that's a different story. But sometimes, you know, the place that's the, you know, driving on the highway, because our highways are so congested now, is slower than driving on the back roads. I mean, anybody that's kind of trying to drive out of Boston down the Southeast Expressway, oftentimes going through Dorchester, going through Milton, coming in the back way, is a much prettier, more pleasant, and less nerve-wracking, and less time-consuming way to go. Anyway,
yeah, let me just
speech.
Say, by the way, you are, unlike you, I don't brag about things. You're bragging that you take the longer route for ecological reasons. I wasn't going to brag, but since you're doing it, I'm going to the Cape this weekend, and I'm biking, actually, which really... Which, what's, why are you laughing?
Okay.
Why are you laughing? 877.
I think the last time you were in a bike, Jim, it did not end well, as I recall.
No, I've got one of those bikes with the clamps on your pedals there, and I forgot I had clamps on the pedals, and I went down for the count. That was my last
lost, Jim.
Bike ride.
It would have been an American tragedy. Thank God you came
it
through.
It was an American tragedy, even though I was not lost. I was bloodied. And it was an emergency.
877-301-8970 is the number. BPR at WGBH.org is the email. You can tweet us at Boss Public Radio. This is, again, it's about little things that people can do.
I agree with
to
that.
Make a difference.
This is a big thing, though. Auto emissions are a big thing. So.
Well, I mean, one of the things we're talking about now is General Motors saying that they're going to go to more and more electric cars. That is a
new
big,
logo.
Is a big deal because Teslas are great, but they're pricey for most people. I would assume the General Motors electric car is going to be a little bit less pricey. Carly from Lowell, thank you for calling.
Hey, Carly.
Hi.
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 Yeah, it's funny that this is the topic because I actually was just talking to the police in Lowell about Waze and how much I dislike it because it causes cars to pass my house that otherwise wouldn't.
Well,
I think it's a danger for kids in the neighborhood, actually.
Well, you know, Carly, you do have a point because I have noticed sometimes Waze will send us down a side street that you normally would never go on, and the people in that side street are wondering why there's a traffic jam in front of their house.
Yeah. And it saves you all of 1 minute, and it's a danger to my kids playing.
Yeah, but here we're not talking about time saving. We're potentially talking about the opposite, Carly. We're talking about earth saving. I assume you're supportive of that, are you not?
Absolutely supportive of that. I mean, I think we need to figure out with these apps because the Lowell police told me they actually contacted Waze to ask them to adjust the app.
Oh, wow.
So there weren't certain cut-throughs and there's nothing that we can do. So it kind of needs to work together. Don't go down this road and find a happy medium so you're not going into neighborhoods you shouldn't be driving in, I guess.
Well, Carly, when they said there's nothing you can do, obviously the one thing you can do is put like hundreds of carpet tacks out in the road. That's one possibility, but I'm not advising that, by the way.
Absolutely, I'm all for it.
Purely for recreational purposes. Carly, thank you very much for the call. 877-301-8970. We're talking about this. Google is doing something good for the world, potentially. Andy was not skeptical. I was a little skeptical. Andy Anatko wasn't. Basically, they're going to provide you the eco-friendly option. And again, that's not a hard choice, I don't think, for most people. The harder choice would be if it turns out the eco-friendly option took a little bit longer, and Marjorie, for one, is first in line to say she's willing to give up a few minutes to save the Earth, which I think
what is it would
a good
do
kind
is,
of thing.
What we believe it would do is Andy said, look at elevation changes. So going up hills obviously uses more gas than going down hills, and look at the things we think like red lights, stop signs, that sort of thing. So, you know, I mean, I think it's kind of a nice. I get Carly's point, though. I do. If I were on the on Waze's favorite alternative route, I could see why you might get upset about it. Anyway, 877-301-8970. I think we
not quite yet. They're screening
yet.
Calls, so we have to.
Okay, we have to wait till late.
Here we go.
You would do this, wouldn't you, Jim?
What's that?
Wouldn't you do this?
Actually, in all seriousness, I know you'll mock me because that's what you do for a living, essentially.
It is.
But
I really love it.
I like alternative routes. And I'm with you. If I'm in a rush, obviously in a rush, I love taking, like, for example, on the Cape, you mentioned the Cape, 6A takes a lot longer to get absolutely everywhere. 6A is beautiful. And,
it is beautiful.
And I don't know if it's more environmentally friendly, but the answer is I would do it. Unless I was in a huge rush. Billy and Beverly, I don't like rushing anywhere anyway. Billy and Beverly, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Yeah, so I think that this whole idea is definitely like a great start. I definitely think that, you know, it is tough trying to choose between like the quickest route and one that is the most like ecologically friendly. But I think it would be cool, maybe by tracking this data, we could eventually like build our infrastructure to be both quick and like function for the environment. So it's definitely a good start.
Thank you, Billy, for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. It is a good, I mean, it's a start. It is not a solution, a big solution. It is a, well, actually it could be a big solution if people took it seriously. No?
Well, you know what's starting to happen, as I've said before? I think people are starting to realize, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who has lived in the same house for like 25 years, massive numbers of trees behind her. They didn't lose trees for years. Now they're losing trees like crazy because of droughts and extremely high winds. And I think it's more and more people are realizing the weather is getting very odd. They're looking at what's, as I'm obsessed with, the water quality, both in the ocean and the lakes down the Cape. You know, people are seeing these dramatic changes, and I think they're beginning to get very concerned about it. Remember what happened with Melnia Cass Boulevard?
I do indeed.
That they were going to take down all those trees along Melnia Cass Boulevard, and the reason was to reduce traffic and to have bike lanes and widen the sidewalks. But people rose up and said, no, you're not going to take down trees and tell us, oh, well, we'll replant more trees. But of course, it takes 50 years for the trees to get to where they were before you chop them down. And there was public protest, and it stopped. I hope that happens at Otis Air Force Base on the Cape, where the National Guard is trying to do the same thing. I mean, we weren't thinking 10 years ago or even 15 years ago. Look at the building in along the waterfront in Boston. We weren't thinking about these things.
So,
I think people's minds have changed.
If people's minds have changed, then once Massachusetts is fully vaccinated, we'll have less gridlock on the roads and more use of public transportation, like come the fall, for example.
Well, again, we're not going to spend enough money to fix public transportation because we've kind of decided, as a nation, that we want to be like a third world country and we can't do things that other countries can do. But I do think, yeah, I think in Boston, because you see more and more young people who do not have cars and they do ride the T.
Okay.
So I wish we were doing better on the T, but at least I think we're going to do something with this money we're going to get from the federal government. Jamie in Cohasset, thanks for calling.
Hello, Jamie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I'm actually on the Cape right now, driving back to the South Shore from getting my COVID vaccine. Very excited.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. I'm very excited. But I'm calling in response to your point on taking different routes to be more environmentally conscious. And Marjorie, I definitely agree with you. If you're in a rush, it's hard. But I think that like as a culture of instant gratification and like wanting to be always in a rush, it's hard to like fully say, absolutely, I'm on board with that. But as somebody who's constantly trying to be more environmentally conscious and like living in just a much more sustainable life and like taking a bit of a beat, I think if that was available to me at all times and I always had an option, I would try to always choose that alternate route to just kind of lessen my personal impact.
Yeah.
Well there's another good soul.
Speaking of the Cape, you know, before there was Route 25 and before there were a 195, I know if you can remember that far, and I can, you go along Route 6 all the way to the Cape. You go by all these clam shacks. You go by all these little hotels. I mean, in many ways, it was a much more pleasant drive. There's not a lot usually exciting to look at on the highway. You know, I know it was great that we did the big dig, even though it cost us a fortune. But think about it. You sit in the tunnels now in traffic. You used to at least sit in the elevated highway and have something to look at. Now you're just sitting. It's not much to look at in a tunnel, Jim, right?
No, I mean, by the way, I mean, it's not just looking at them, which is huge, and it's big to me, too. But this ecologically friendly thing is a big deal, which is why not only, to end this, I am cycling to the Cape, even though Marjorie thinks I'm not. I'm skateboarding to GBH tomorrow morning.
Oh, you're skateboarding.
Early. So if you see me on Memorial Drive, that... Well, you see a fairly large
person.
I think
you look cute in one of those scooters, Jim. You get the big boy scooter.
Yeah,
but I think you'd be good on one of those.
Yeah. Okay, we're done.
We're done. Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we're going to be joined by our BPR All-Stars, Callie Crossley, Sue O'Connell, Corby Cummer is going to be here tomorrow. Our crew, Chelsea Murs, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aidan Conley, and Mackenzie Farkas. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker, Miles Smith, and Dave Goldstein run our remote studios. We want to thank them very much. Are you on TV tonight, Jim?
No, Adam is sitting in. He's got a great show, actually. He's got Diane Wilkerson and Eric Estevez, who are trying to coalesce the candidates of color, which is virtually all of them, running for mayor to coalesce around one candidate. He'll be talking to him. He'll also be talking to Eric Edstrom, who's written a book, Un-American, A Soldier's Reckoning of Our Largest War. He's going to talk about Biden's announcement to withdraw troops from Afghanistan on September 11th. Sounds like a great show. Again, Adam Riley will be hosting. I'll be back next week there. And we'll both be back tomorrow. So that's it, I think.
I'll be looking for you on your skateboard, Jim.
But, you know, let me tell you something. Just check it out tomorrow morning.
Okay.
And you will... remember I made it into that movie, America at 15 Miles an Hour?
Oh, my God.
And they shot me from behind, below. So essentially all you could see on the screen of this film, this is true, on a Segway was my, how should I put it, rear end on
Jim's
the whole screen. That was a hell of a shot, if you know what I mean.
Formidable derriere.
Okay, fine. I made the point. You don't have to underline it. I am Jim Brown.
Marjorie.
That's a true story, by the way. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Thanks for listening. Bye.